so I just ripped it.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the committee today. Must be something important we're doing today with all these people here. Okay. We have an informational hearing today on the topic of HMOs and et cetera. I appreciate the interest. This is a very important topic. I'd say it's controversial, parts of it. I think some matters of it are delicate. Take that as it is. The point of today is not to embarrass anybody or castigate anybody or anything like that. We're not going to be questioning people's motives or personalities. We're going to ask a lot of questions. And I would request that the witnesses kind of hold to that. And that'll be a productive thing. Some people asked about public testimony. We are not having public testimony today for the simple reason there is no bill in front of us. This is an informational hearing to gather information, and there'll be a time for public testimony later when actually a bill arises, probably starting in a reform committee, and whatever that form that bill takes, then people could react to that, and there'll be ample time, I'm sure the chair assures me, for that. So what we are, the two chairs up here, and he can speak for himself, but we feel a duty to explore topics that come our way. However, some are very simple, some are very complicated and controversial. That would be this one. There'll be time, a lot of time for members to ask questions. So the format we're going to be, do you want to say something first? Then I'll,
sure. Okay. I want to thank everybody for taking the time and attention to be here because, as Representative Abler pointed out, this is an extremely important issue. I would point out, too, this is not something that just suddenly came up. I think some people have that perception. We have, in fact, and I'm sure members of both sides of the aisle who are sitting here at the table from both committees will acknowledge, we've been talking about transparency and where the money is spent in a variety of government programs and health and human services programs in particular in all the time that I've been in this legislature. So we have been talking about where's the money going. Some people have described it as the black box. Others have asked about HMO transparency or whether the department or administration should be looking at this more closely under both administrations. So this has been coming for quite a while. Some new information has come to light more recently that we felt required us as representatives of Minnesotans to have an informational hearing to find out more about this and find out if, in fact, there are things that either need to be corrected or modified in state government or, in fact, if there's any wrongdoing going on. We need to know about that on behalf of our constituents. But this is not a witch hunt, and we are trying to deal with this constructively and respectfully, and yet at the same time, I think, try to get at some important facts. So I want to thank everybody who's participating in the hearing today, and the committee members, and my co-chair, and my wife, too, for loaning me today on Valentine's Day. So.
And Mr. Feinwalk, you can come to the table and get set up if you like. Then I have a couple more things to say. Welcome Senator Nino, who is here, and I don't know who else is in the audience from the Senate or other members. I hope there's room for everybody to sit. If there's other members in the audience from House or Senate, they're welcome to sit at the table with us, too. I think we have ample seats, but that way it makes more room for other people who don't get to sit at the table. We're going to hear three half-hour presentations from three different groups, Mr. Feinwalks, the department, and then the plans. And I believe in that order. I think that makes the most sense. So I'd rather hold questions till the end. There'll be an entire hearing time available. We'll take a break somewhere in the middle when it makes sense, and then Chair Gottwald will have the gavel to do that second half. I did just, for people's information, there's a lot of numbers get thrown around. The amount of money spent in medical assistance managed care in 12 was $3.3 billion, state and federal, and $3.6 billion in 2013, so it's about $6.9 billion for the biennium. So everybody has these numbers. That I just read them off the forecast for you. So went to 3, now it's 4. Well, kind of. You're around 3.2 down to 3, and you're running 3.6 up to 4. Anyway, we just want to have action. We want good facts. We want good data. And that's, I think, all I have. Mr. Feinwachs, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself, and I think you have a presentation for us.
Chairman Abler, Chairman Gottwall, thank you. My name is David Feinwachs. I'm a resident of the city of St. Paul, and I'm here today representing no group or interest in particular. I want to begin my comments by saying this. What I'm about to say is, I think, the most important thing that I'm going to say, and if you remember nothing else that is said by me today, I would ask you to remember this. Our Department of Human Services has almost 7,000 employees. Minnesota's health plans have many thousands of employees. None of this is about any of them. These people work hard. They do important work. They try to facilitate the provision of health care services. They go to work every day to support their families and make sure that medical claims are processed and bills get paid and that duplication and error is ferreted out and dealt with. And 99.99% of these people have nothing to do with any of this and are a credit to the health care system and really should be acknowledged as that. And I have not a single thing to say about them except to thank them for their commitment. Having said that, what I want to talk to you today is about process and our system and certain aspects of our system that we are all responsible for and that we need to look at and evaluate. The first slide, which is in the PowerPoint presentation, which is on the monitors and which you can see, I've recently been involved in some litigation, which is irrelevant to this issue, but did give me access to some things. And in the litigation, one of the things that I allege I heard was on August 13, I was a participant in a conference call involving a DHS employee where the statement was made, if you can't keep a secret, you have to leave the room, but we've been adjusting the reserve amount for state-only funded programs, making it essentially zero, and increasing the amount for PMAP federal programs, blending the rate, and returning it to the insurers. And now, when I heard this, I believe this to be impermissible. I believe that if indeed this is occurring, it is improper and problematic. As part of my litigation process, I had the opportunity to take the deposition of the employee that I heard make this statement. And the second slide that you see here is the cover sheet of that deposition. The next page is the employee, Karen Peed, answering the question directly, did you say this? And Ms. Peed did not recall making this statement. She acknowledged it may have been possible, but she didn't recall. I also had the opportunity to take the deposition of a man named Matthew Anderson, who was a former colleague and today works still at the Minnesota Hospital Association. Mr. Anderson was present at the call, and in his deposition, you'll see that Mr. Anderson says that he, and I quote, I don't know if that was her exact words, but there was part of the call where she was describing a DHS process that she didn't want us to tell or, you know, disclose widely. And then Mr. Anderson goes on to say, what I understood her to say was that programs outside a federal match, that the state was decreasing the amount that it calculated or anticipated health plans would have as a reserve or margin down to zero, and using PMAP rates to leverage those higher so in the end the plans are made whole and the state leverages more federal money. Mr. Anderson goes on to say she did not indicate that the money was returned to the plans. Mr. Anderson's recollection is fairly close to my recollection and then leaves us with the first important issue, are we in fact doing this? I also had the opportunity to take the deposition of Ms. Nancy Feldman, who, as many of you know, is the CEO of UCARE. Ms. Feldman made a statement in response to a memorandum that had been written about why these programs can't be looked at in isolation, and I believe this is a true statement. Because the way we look at our products is total bottom line, the state products. The products all intertwine. It's very difficult to pull them apart and look at the bottom line. I believe the federal regulations require that we do, in fact, pull them apart and that they not intertwine. I may be incorrect about this, but I believe some separate accounting is part of the federal regulatory scheme. The next slide that I am showing you is a letter dated November 10, 2003, which is a letter that was received by then DHS Commissioner Kevin Goodnow from the Office of Inspector General from the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And this letter dealt with an audit of our Department of Human Services and some of the calculations. And the part that I've highlighted for you reads in pertinent part, and this is the OIG speaking. We noted the state agency included administrative costs and a profit factor for its state-funded prepaid general assistance medical care, general assistance program, in the actuarial rate calculations for the program, meaning the Medicaid program, in 2001 and 2002. This was contrary to federal cost principles and misstated the actuarial calculations available for future rate setting. Now, to their credit, my understanding is that DHS did not implement this once it was pointed out to them by the Office of Inspector General and did not use this sort of actuarial misrepresentation and, in fact, abandoned it. Recently, in 2010, we saw a number of bills introduced that had a common theme. The common theme of this legislation was auditing, the use of generally accepted accounting principles, the imposition of medical loss ratios to better track and account for the money, and forfeitures or givebacks, if you will, if these bills were to pass, of the state's vendors in the event they were found to have retained too much of the money that was given to them for programmatic purposes. They would then refund the impermissible excess, according to the proposed legislation, back to the state of Minnesota. The current slide is a fiscal note which analyzes those kinds of proposals, and what is interesting about it is the end, in particular the last sentence, because the fiscal note says, if a health plan doesn't meet, in this case, the 93.5%, but the numbers are relevant, loss ratio, and pays a penalty, the cost of paying the penalty will be included in the health plan's experience in subsequent years and may result in higher DHS capitation rates. This is important for two reasons. I believe the word may is included here because I'm not sure DHS knows what's in those capitation rates. And more importantly, if the statement is a true statement and the plans recover their costs and expenses in the subsequent year, these are not actually risk contracts, but more in the nature of reimbursement contracts, which then asks the important question, why are we reserving in large quantities against what appears to be non-existent risk? The next two emails that are on the screen, these are a couple of emails that occurred on the evening of March 15. And they're important only in that they set a backdrop. They are emails between the commissioner and one of her assistants discussing the extraordinary event of UCARE returning to the state some $30 million. The $30 million give back was quite remarkable. I don't think anyone in recent memory had ever seen anything like this. You'll see at the bottom the first email from Mr. Pollack, who at the time was with DHS, says, unfortunately, I think this really good news is likely to generate far more questions from legislators about our PMAP contracts and adequacy of health plan reserves. And the responsive email from the commissioner states, in order to have a good chance of keeping the money, it must be characterized as a donation. If a refund, the feds clearly get half, which is true. Can you work with Scott on redrafting? And also, I thought we were going to handle this through phone calls. Now, the importance of these emails is that on the 15th, on the evening of the 15th, there is not a doubt in my mind that people thought that UCARES Act was, in fact, a donation, a gift. And these emails, I think, reflect that thinking. The next day, UCARE distributed the following letter to a handful of select legislators. This letter reads in pertinent part, Historically, DHS rates set for general assistance medical care resulted in health plan losses. Now, that is no shocking news. Every medical provider you will ever talk to will tell you that the GAMC program was underfunded, ill-conceived, and a horrible program for healthcare providers. There's no shocking news there. It goes on to say, which were offset by higher medical assistance payments. And I think most providers would be surprised by that because they don't think they've received any higher medical assistance payments to offset the GAMC program. The letter also says when GAMC moved out of managed care in mid-year 2010, when Governor Pawlenty dismantled the program and did away with it, medical assistance rates were not lowered to reflect this overpayment. And the word overpayment here is key, because I know that Chair Gottwald said, and I agree with him, and this is the only time I will deviate, I am not here to cast blame, except in this case, the blame falls with the legislature. It falls with all of you, because you received $30 million accompanied by a letter that referred to overpayment. Yet, no one asked the question, how could such an overpayment occur? No one asked the question, who else might owe the refund of an overpayment? No one asked the question, is the amount of the overpayment being given back sufficient? And no one asked the question, what steps will we take in the future to assure that whatever caused this overpayment isn't repeated in the future? These, I would respectfully submit to you, are the questions of a prudent fiduciary, and I think many people were disappointed and dismayed that these inquiries did not occur. In 2008, our legislative auditor did a report, and this report was a very well done document, 175 pages in length, and I suspect that only persons such as myself who enjoy reading this kind of thing, delved into it in any detail. But nevertheless, it is quite an excellent, if not analysis, compendium of observations about our programs and some interesting things. And I'm going to revisit that briefly and share some of it with you. The legislative auditor can observe that our managed care capitation rates for these public programs are relatively high compared with other states, that our spending per enrollee grew faster than the national rate in recent years. Nevertheless, all of you have heard the bitter complaining from providers that they've not seen increases and that their payment hasn't changed or is woefully inadequate. This stands in stark contrast to these facts observed by the legislative auditor. The auditor also observed a very important thing, and that is, in recent years, health plans haven't reported aggregate losses from public programs. If you talk to providers, and I don't care who the providers are, hospitals, doctors, chiropractors, podiatrists, dentists, all of these providers will report to you that they lose on these programs individually and they lose on these programs in the aggregate. Yet the auditor observes that the plans do not report losses in recent years in the aggregate. Now, what on earth could account for this? Going back to Karen Peed's statement, Karen Peed's statement really becomes the Rosetta Stone. It's this statement which gives us the ability to understand and explain some of the observations which were made. When the legislative auditor conducted this report, made this inquiry and published this document, they didn't know this. Now, armed with that information, this would put some of these observations in a whole new light.
Mr. Feinwachs, you're just about halfway.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. I'm going to skip over some of the rest of the slides from the legislative auditor's report. This one, of course, says that the health department relies on the Commerce Department. The Commerce Department concerns itself with the wealth of health plans, and DHS doesn't collect detailed information on administrative costs regarding these programs. That's true. Even in 2008, the legislative auditor noted that there appear to be no actuarial standards of practice for this function. 2 years later, in 2010, the General Accountability Office said exactly the same thing in a published report that was critical of the federal government's oversight of these programs. The American Academy of Actuaries last January 2011 wrote a letter which contained this statement on page 6, and this is extremely important because this says that the state's actuary is not required to look for false or intentionally misleading data. They're not required to develop compilations to search for this kind of data, and they're not required to audit the data. From a policy perspective, you need to ask two questions. One, what exactly does the actuary do in these circumstances? And two, who does these things? Because it appears that no one does these things. Shortly after I took Ms. Peed's deposition, Ms. Peed left her position as the head of the Medicaid Managed Care for DHS and appears to have been reassigned. We have been pushing for a little over a year to find out if it has been permissible that the state's consulting actuary also has been allowed to consult with the state's vendors. Now, let me be perfectly clear about this. There is nothing to suggest that this consultation occurred. I don't know if the state's actuary consulted with the state's vendors, but DHS has recently told us that until now, such consultation has been possible. It has been allowable. Until the 2012 contract, the state's actuary would not have been prohibited from consulting with the state's vendors. The next few slides are a presentation which UCARE gave to a handful of select legislators, and I want to just deal with a couple of them. The first one is this, dealing with encounter data. As you all know, encounter data, and I know you, Chair Gottwald, have tried to obtain this kind of data for going on 3 years. Encounter data is the kind of data that talks about who got what kind of health care services. According to the slide prepared by UCARE, it says, encounter data can be reconciled to health plan financial statements, but will not tie because of accrual accounting rules. This means, by definition, we can never adequately track this money. If true, this is unacceptable. The next slide I want to draw your attention to is slide 26, which says at the bottom, state budget pressures sometimes influence capitation rates based on factors outside the scope of the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program is a program which is 50% funded by the federal government. By definition, there are no factors outside the scope of the Medicaid program which influence the rates, which are certified to the federal government as capitation for the program. The money can't be used to backfill other needs. The money can't be used to subsidize things that don't qualify for federal money. This statement is problematic. Now, the one explanation, in fairness, for this statement would be perhaps there are years when the state didn't just have the money to put up and get all the federal matching funds. But, of course, that's not the case. Year after year after year, the cost of the Medicaid program has increased. The state has put up more and more money every year, and the amount of federal match has always increased. So that explanation also does not appear to be viable here. According to UCARE, and this is absolutely true, insurance companies establish the need for risk reserve by looking at asset underwriting credit and business risk. I ask you, members of the committee, what is the asset underwriting credit and business risk of a scheme in which everyone recovers all of their costs plus an increase in the subsequent year? This, by the way, a number of people have been told that the calculation of insurance risk is an art form, not a science. This is what I will call an amusing slide. This is actually how insurance risk reserve is calculated. It is a problem in differential calculus. There is nothing artistic, and for that matter, nothing amusing, because I took differential calculus, about these equations or this slide. It is a scientific, precise process. This is one of the rate certification actuary letters from the state's consulting actuary, Milliman. It's important for a couple of reasons, because if you look at it, it says The capitation rates for this program are determined on a quarterly basis by blending, and that's the word Ms. Pede used, blending demographic rates which do not vary by managed care organizations. So the demographic rates, they are what they are. It doesn't matter who you who insures you, and that makes sense. And risk-adjusted rates which do vary, which asks the question, how are the risk-adjusted rates calculated, and why are they different? And how do these things come about? Milliman goes on in the center of the letter to disclaim, saying that the letter is only for DHS and no one else should or must rely on it. And, of course, on the second page, as the American Academy of Actuaries has suggested, they say they don't audit or verify this. They're just dealing with what they were given. And this leads us to an extremely important issue. Who sets and certifies the Medicaid rate in the state of Minnesota to the federal government? We've been asking this question for a number of years. The health plans say DHS does it. DHS says the state's actuary does it. The state's actuary says that DHS and the health plans do it. Someone must do it, and someone must be accountable for having done it. We cannot have a system where everybody points fingers at someone else and says, it's not my job. It has to be someone's job. The last series of slides are basically a series of emails that were obtained during the course of litigation that talk about legislative proposals. And they're only significant because of their response. This is a slide from the Council of Health Plans that talked about a piece of legislation that would have required audits and limitation on administrative expense. And it says it would require the plans to have to refund federal matching dollars, and DHS would have to do that too. Why? The question that must be asked is why? This is a slide that talks about me, apparently, and says that I had convinced then-Senator Linda Berglund that the elimination of GAMC would cause a windfall for the plans. The fascinating thing is the slide says that when Karen Pede learned of this, she said that DHS would have to pay the plans back for any assessment. They would have to build it back into the rates. Again, the question arises, why? Why on earth would something like that occur? This is an email from I believe, Julie Bruner to the CEO of Health Partners and the CEO of UCare, talking about a conversation with Karen Pede from DHS, and Ms. Pede is reporting to them that a retired DHS employee had been interviewed by an attorney and asked about health plan or the Medicaid rate setting and contracting, and many people were upset about this. And, in fact, I was the root cause of this inquiry. What's interesting here is Ms. Pede was and is a public employee. If she had a concern about this line of inquiry, why wasn't this email addressed to the commissioner or her superior or any of the other people employed at DHS? Why is it addressed to the Council of Health Plans? This is an email which shows in the section, it's an email that was sent by the CEO of Health Partners while on vacation in Glacier Park, having learned that the retired DHS employee had been asked how the program works, and the email says, we need to connect with board members on this one, it is really bad. How really bad is it to ask a retired employee how the program works, or how it worked when he was involved in running it? The next email talks about these being serious allegations. The next one talks about these are serious and allegations of illegality. And I apologize for the scan. It's cut off. But that's what that word says. Illegality on the part of the plans. These people are talking to each other. There is no external voice. No one suggested illegality. This is an email from someone at Medica talking about a hospital system that asked them to walk through the Medicaid rate setting process. And it says, then they asked if we could walk them through the process. I'm sure you'll agree this statement goes beyond a reference to a black box and indirectly accuses DHS of not complying with federal laws. No one said that. Where does that come from? This is an email which I think, if anything, is the one that is most easily understandable and the one which cries out for what's required here. This is an email from the council to its own staff talking about the preparation of a rebuttal to the materials that I have prepared in my allegations. This talks about Pat Garrity, who at the time was the head of Blue Cross, and it says we need to get some information. What's interesting here is you'll notice it says in all cap letters, just ask for the Medicaid spending in all categories, just the Medicaid spending, and then it says we need it to add up to 100% somehow. And I think that pretty much describes the problem, because for all of us, for the taxpayers, for the legislature, for everyone in this room today, we need it to add up to 100% somehow. And the fact that it doesn't cries out for an independent audit and some reconciliation of these programs. The next email discusses me and describes the fact that, I'm on a mission and that the plans can only hope that my rhetoric is so extreme that I marginalize myself. I would hope that the plans could only hope that they could refute this, that they could explain this, that they could show what it is that has been overlooked, misunderstood, or mischaracterized. Because if this is their only hope, this is a long shot. This is an email from Julie Bruner to an attorney who's with a firm that represents UCARE. It's kind of a Christmas email. It talks about the holiday season and good cheer and good wine. It also talks about a video that I made, which some of you have seen, a half-hour boring video. And it says, I'm not sure how he thinks he's going to prove collusion between DHS and the plans on PMAP, but he clearly insinuates it in his video. I insinuated nothing in my video other than no one knows how this works and no one can appear to figure it out or account for it. And so this is an unusual email. It also goes on to say it's unclear what the ask is unless it's for the plans to disclose what they pay, and it ends with, don't think that's going to happen. The final email is an odd email. It involves me personally. And it is, from my perspective, bizarre. It is an email from Julie Bruner at the Minnesota Council of Health Plans to the gentleman who fired me. And it says, I hope you put some restrictions on what he can say in his severance agreement. And I assume the misspelling there refers to MHA. I'm here to tell you today for the record that there were ample restrictions in that agreement on what I could say in both of those agreements. I'm also here to tell you that I took neither one of them. The final email also tells the story. It's an email from the Council of Health Plans to Commissioner Jessen before she was the commissioner, telling her, giving her a link to the video and saying this is the Finewalks effort that got him dismissed from the Hospital Association but is getting some media attention. At the time, Channel 5 was covering it, I believe. It goes on to say, I'm concerned it not get traction with the Dayton camp without a chance to discuss the real facts involved in the story. And members, that's where we are. We need to know what are the real facts in the story. If we are engaged in the activity that Ms. Peed described in her statement, which I heard and which Ms. Anderson, which Mr. Anderson heard, we have to ask, is this a legitimate activity? Is it permissible? Is it a gray area? Is it unlawful? And if it is, in its kindest characterization, a gray area, let us say for the sake of argument, do we want the people's business done in a gray area? Is this the reason for the secrecy that seems to surround the operation of these programs for these many years? Because no one wanted to talk about this or draw any attention to it? Well, it's out there now. So if we're not doing it, that's fine. If we're doing it, we need to address it. And going forward, we need to address, are we going to allow the people's business, even outsourced business, to be conducted in secrecy? Should the public not know where its money goes? Almost 20 years ago, scholars were writing articles saying, It's a bad idea to outsource these programs. If you outsource these programs, you're going to lose your most valuable resource, data and information about how they work. You're going to lose information about the cost of health care, who's providing it, who's paid for it, what works, what doesn't work. And 20 years ago, it was predicted we'd end up with a black box. I respectfully submit to you, we have that black box. It is a disadvantage to every consumer who has an HSA, who would desperately benefit from information the state might have to offer about the real costs of health care. It is a disadvantage to policymakers such as yourselves, who are being asked to trust blindly and, more importantly, fly blindly in the crafting of policies. And it is a disadvantage to every medical provider in this state who is, in essence, compelled by what we call Rule 101 to be forced to participate in these programs no matter what, yet they cannot see how these programs work, and they are left to wonder whether the financial losses they incur benefit the patients, the state of Minnesota, or simply profit some intermediary broker. As always, I appreciate the opportunity to speak. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you, and I appreciate your being right on time with your presentation. The department can come down now. And so it's my intention, if anybody came in late, members, we're going to take all the testimony, and then when that's completed, then we'll call the group up, and there'll be something of a panel, and we'll have a dialogue for a period of hours about this. And there'll be a break in the middle sometime. Commissioner, welcome. Mr. Leitz, welcome. You have a half hour, and the time is yours to spend as you wish.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm glad I'm not the only one wearing a little red. And just thank you for the opportunity to talk about some of these things, to talk about the Department of Human Services' role in contracting with managed care plans to provide health care services in both our MA and our Minnesota care programs. Before I jump into the substance of my testimony today, I just want to make it clear what I'm going to cover, what Assistant Commissioner Leitz is going to address today, and hopefully between the two of us, we can answer questions you have, if not during our testimony, then afterwards. So in my testimony, I'm going to discuss the situation that Commissioner Leitz and I found the healthcare area of the department's work when I started a year and a month ago today as commissioner. I'll talk about some of the actions that we've taken based upon our assessment, as well as what we plan to do in the future and where we think this should go. Assistant Commissioner Leitz is going to talk about the work in more detail that we've done on competitive bidding, the status of the audits that are being done by the Department of Commerce under the governor's executive order, and he's going to also update you on some other reporting and data analysis pieces. So if I could start, and bear with me a little bit here, because I want to just start, kind of take a step back and talk about the general structure of our state's public health care programs today, but I also want to talk a little bit about where I think they're headed in the future. Because I think while we have this conversation, and don't worry, I'm going to get to it, let's do it thinking about where, not just where we are and where we've been, but where we want to go. As you all know, Minnesota made a decision a number of years ago that many of the enrollees in our public health insurance programs would be enrolled in managed care. A primary reason, as I understand it, and you all were here before I was, but as I understand it, it was to ensure adequate access to our services for all of our medical assistance enrollees. And this has been largely successful on this measure. You do not hear widespread concerns about access to services under medical assistance. I know that's not true for every enrollee or every service. I'm thinking of kind of some dental services here. But overall, I think that is true. And that is something that managed care has helped us to facilitate in Minnesota, and we should acknowledge that. And like other states where they allow for-profit health plans to participate in Medicaid, Minnesota does not. And I think this has helped our state manage costs and ensure the taxpayers get more value for their dollars. And finally, I think managed care provides more coordination, care coordination, than in our fragmented fee-for-service system. Not always as much as I would hope for, but more. So collectively, for many of our enrollees, this has been a good fit, and they're able to receive the services they need. For other individuals, such as many of our disabled individuals, they have historically found our fee-for-service system to be one that gave them a much broader choice of providers, something that they greatly valued and was much better for them. But frankly, coming in, I see problems with both of these systems. You know, under our purely unfettered fee-for-service system, it can lead to bad incentives. The incentives are do more tests, more visits, lack of emphasis on incentives for high-quality outcomes, lack of care coordination, though we're trying to address that through our medical home progress. And frankly, our rates are so low that we do have access problems in parts of our state. And, you know, as we'll address a little more later, historically on the managed care front, we have not done enough to either contain costs in these programs or to incentivize better care in many of our products. So what I want to make clear is that, as we see with both systems, neither is perfect. They both carry advantages and disadvantages. And while we're here today to mostly talk on the managed care side about how we can better manage our costs and their services in those contracts, I think we do need to start by saying fixing that alone really is not enough. That we really, and what we are trying to do, in addition to the work we're doing on managed care and our fee-for-service systems in the department, is really try and create a third way. This is an approach where we contract directly with providers to provide care, where the incentives are better aligned with better care, lower costs for specific populations. So under this approach, which we are pushing, providers will be given more flexibility to innovate and deliver care that, in a way that they know, providers are closest to it, they know are going to get results. In the past, when providers created innovations that saved money, had better outcomes, often they were penalized because those savings accrued to health plans or employers. So under what I'm calling our third way, we want providers to share in savings that they create through innovations. We want to provide more direct incentives for high-quality, low-cost care. That's why we put out, as many of you know, a request for proposals last summer, and we were really delighted to receive 9 proposals to participate in this demonstration project. These providers from all regions of our states, rural, urban, large, small, and I think this offers a real promising pathway to better care and lower costs for the people we serve. You know, one of these projects was with Hennepin County that we recently agreed to, where they are agreeing to coordinate all their social service delivery, not just health care, in an attempt to achieve better outcomes amongst the hard-to-serve early expansion population. So historically, while I think the state has been behind the curve, behind the private sector in this kind of care, we are now trying to assume more of a leadership role and hope to move forward with this new care model. So thanks for bearing with me. But I do want to say that is the direction where I think we're going. But we can't get there overnight. These are demonstration projects. So in the meantime, we have to deal with the 2 programs we have, and particularly today, talk about dealing with our managed care plans. So let me say where we were, I think, when I started as commissioner. Now, I want to just give a little context here. When I came in the Department of Human Services, it's not like I found that everything was dire. There's a lot of great work going on at the department. Last fall, as many of you know, we were received an award. Minnesota was recognized as being the number one state in the country for delivering home and community-based services. And that's an amazing thing, a tribute to our providers and advocates, to many of you. You know, and I didn't say to myself, oh, wow, that happened because I've been Commissioner of Human Services for 10 months. I know that was the work of many of the providers and advocates, I said, and you, but also for hardworking employees of the department and the leadership, frankly, of the department over the past decade. So I just want to be clear that when I'm talking about things I wanted to change, there were many things I think which are a real tribute to our employees and to previous commissioners. But one of the 2 things I thought we most needed to change and change quickly became when I became commissioner, and which was also a concern with the governor, were a number of issues with state contracting for managed care plans. You know, I didn't come into this just as a totally blank slate. I remember back when I was Assistant Attorney General for the state of Minnesota back in the mid-1990s. One of the things I did was I worked for the state employee health plan, and I helped negotiate some of their contracts. But I also, another part of my job as assistant attorney general, I did some work for DHS. And one of the things that struck me even then, years, decades ago, was we were doing things with our state employee insurance plan that were innovative and creative, and we weren't doing it on the PMAP side. So it was something, I think, because of that, and I tried to draw attention to it, but not very successfully, that I kind of followed this across the years when after I left state service in 1998. I remember even a few years ago, I was moderating a discussion about things that in the private sector they were doing. I remember there were folks from Fairview and Medica there talking about some innovative payment structures. So instead of just doing fee-for-service or traditional, you know, capitation, they were really trying to pay for the value of better services and to incentivize efficiencies. But when I came to the department, I didn't see those innovations. The governor and I also concerned about the increasing profit margins. For periods of time, the health plans were making more money on public programs than they were on the private programs. And what that told me was we weren't doing a good job negotiating those deals. The large amount of reserves, much of which was attributable to public programs, another concern. And also just the concern, frankly, with the amount and accessibility of information which is available about the contracting process and the contracting process itself. As I said, I recognized the positive aspects that managed care brought in terms of needed access to service for our enrollees. But I found, overall, there wasn't the accountability we need. And frankly, I thought we were leaving money on the table in our contracting and that we needed to do a much better job. But I want to be very clear as well. I didn't believe this, that we needed more accountability, that we weren't doing it being as aggressive with our contracting, that we were leaving money on the table because I believed that there was any fraud going on. I didn't see that. I didn't see any deliberate wrongdoing, but rather I just believed we were not leveraging the very best deals we could. I think it's fair for all of you to ask me, say, okay, now, Cindy, you've heard these accusations about kind of things that were done in the past. And this was back when the GAMC program was up and running, which we're not dealing with anymore. What are you going to do about that, even though it's not happening right now? And those of you who know me know I do not hesitate to investigate wrongdoing. That's one of the reasons we instituted the Office of Inspector General in the department this past year. But in this case, at the same time that I first heard of the allegations, which Mr. Feinwalks referred to, was when I also became aware that federal authorities were investigating a number of these allegations. I can't say much about the scope of that investigation or the entities involved. I became aware of it because they were asking for cooperation from the department, and we are fully cooperating. But because I think it was a legitimate question to say, why aren't you investigating, the answer is because federal authorities are investigating this, and we're cooperating with them. Setting that aside, I believe that we really set about, shortly after I became commissioner working with the governor, we wanted to get more accurate, complete information, make this process more open, and to make us a smarter purchaser of health care. So a couple of things we did pretty quickly last year. As many of you know, the governor issued an executive order on March 23rd to deal with disclosure and accountability in our managed care contracts. It required audits in the managed care plans by the Department of Commerce, created a comprehensive annual report on all the administrative expenses, because I agree, we need to dive into that more, premium revenues and information on quality, access, and enrollment. It made data on the plans and contracts open to the full public disclosure via a new public website, which included all the public data that we could find and put it in one place. Now, can we do more? Can the legislature do more to create some accountability and transparency than the governor can in the executive order? Yes, and we would support that. And I'll talk about that towards the end. But other people came up to me and said, Cindy, you've got to change these contracts. Well, I'm a lawyer, and I know after contracts are signed and negotiated, you just don't go and one party doesn't walk in and change them, even when you have questions about it. But what we did do was I approached the plans, and we negotiated voluntary caps on profits for the 2011 contracts. In early April, we reached a voluntary agreement with the four major health plans that for a one-time cap on 2011 earnings at 1% of revenue. And I want to thank the health plans for agreeing to those caps. Now, people say, why did you do it only for that year? Well, the reason we did it for that year is because we knew going forward we were going to change the way we did contracting. And Scott's going to talk a little bit more about that, but let me just open it up on the competitive, about why we decided to do competitive bidding. And I know competitive bidding is something that's been talked about by many of you on a bipartisan basis in the past. I guess the only thing I would say is we did it. We did it quickly, and we got dollars that helped to deal with the budget deficit last year. Now, one of the reasons I thought we needed competitive bidding was because I think Mr. Feinwalks talked about the fact that there wasn't enough risk in these contracts, and that was a concern I had. You know, and I know I'm being simplistic here, but basically the way I saw it is we decided what to pay the health plans next year by looking about how much they charged us and how much we paid them for the last 3 years, and then we added medical inflation to that. Well, I look at that and say, well, where's the incentive to change? We had some small withholds, but not much. And I am all about the fact that we need to change incentives if we want to change behaviors. So rather than just doing rate setting a different way, we said, let's just put these contracts out for bid. And Scott, do you want to maybe say a few words about that, and then I can finish up?
Thank you, Commissioner. Members of the committee, my name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. And I want to reiterate Commissioner Justin's thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the efforts we've undertaken in this area. I also want to start by strongly reiterating the Commissioner's comments about the very serious immediate look that we took at our purchasing practices when we took office. As many of you know, in the Governor's budget last year, we did roll out a new approach to purchasing for our managed care products. Rather than purely doing rate setting, as the Commissioner just described, as we had done in the past, we moved rapidly to introduce a concept that, frankly, we were somewhat surprised had never actually been introduced in these programs before, and that is the concept of competitive bidding and the ability of plans to compete against each other for business in the public programs. It was an effort to bring market competition, to bring the best price and best quality for our enrollees. And we started this process in the Twin Cities area. And the reason we did that was that coverage for our 7-county metro area and reprocurement for those health plans was due up anyway.
Just your 15 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we won't dwell on this point, but I wanted to just drive down the point that we acted very rapidly to really change the way that we did our healthcare purchasing, I think for many of the reasons that have already been discussed today. We did go through that process, and at the end of this year issued contracts to plans, but I want to talk briefly about the results that we actually achieved on that. And I know this committee has heard this before, but I just want to reiterate that, as the Commissioner said, there were real savings that were actually accrued from this process. The contracts alone that we cut saved about $175 million to the state for the biennium through the mere introduction of competitive forces in this process. Not only does that help us in the short run, but we also believe it will help to lower the cost curve moving into the future. And overall, when you combine that with some of the other reforms that we have, close to a $250 million was saved of state money as a result of that process. Very briefly, Mr. Chair, one of the things that we've been going through right now, and I think I have testified in front of your committee about this already, we're going through the process of transitioning enrollees from the plans that they were in to the plans that were selected, because we did not select every plan that was available in every county. Federal law requires us in the metropolitan area to contract with at least 2 plans, and we did that in all of the counties in the 7-county metro. For 4 of the counties, there's 2 plans operating. And then in 3 of the counties where we had the most population and the most people moving, to ensure we had smooth transition of almost 80,000 people who were going to be changing plans, we did add a 3rd plan to ensure that continuity was able to be achieved. Mr. Chair, we're also planning to rigorously evaluate this process. We want to learn from this process so that we can do it better into the future. We think this was a good start. We think this proved to be very effective. But we want to ensure that we get better in the future on this as well. We also, as part of the competitive bidding process, I would say that's just one important strategy that we have right now in terms of overall managed care reforms that are projected to save the money I discussed. One of the things that I wanted to just touch very briefly on, Mr. Chair, is that we We're also very focused in the governor's executive order that the commissioner referenced earlier on one of the elements that Mr. Feinwatz talked about, and that's bringing some additional level of audit to the data and information that is submitted by the health plans. So let me talk very briefly about that, Mr. Chair. As part of the governor's executive order, the DHS is entering into an agreement with the Department of Commerce to conduct audits of the health plans. Commerce does already contract with a third-party outside auditor to conduct these audits, and these audits will begin in the late spring with filings that are submitted by the health plans for their operation for their 2011 operational year. So those filings are typically brought in April, and the audits of those of that information will be conducted at that time. These audits will focus on two primary areas. First and very importantly, we will be reconciling what is submitted under those financial statements and ensuring that that reconciles with what is submitted for rate development. That is something that has been lacking in the past, so we want to ensure that we're creating that tie between information that's coming from various sources. It's important that what plans are filing with regulators square with the data that's submitted for the development of rates for those public insurance programs. And this is particularly important for 2011 because, as the commissioner mentioned, we reached a voluntary agreement with the health plans to cap profits for the final year of contracts that were negotiated previously at 1%. And so we want to make sure that that information is tying to the financials. And we will look aggressively at any discrepancies that we find. Secondly, one of the things that Mr. Feinwatz discussed was the fact that we previously did not have good allocation of administrative expenses across programs. And with the legislature's help last year, we passed a law to allow us to collect more detailed information on all of the public programs that we operate, especially on the administrative cost side. The audit will take a look at that information that's being collected and ensuring that we fully understand how things are being allocated from an administrative expense perspective. We do not, as a public health insurance program, want to be paying more than our fair share of administrative expenses relative to the commercial market. Lastly, the last thing I'll say before turning it back to Commissioner Jessen is that we will be examining the encounter data that's submitted by the health plans. For the first time this year, and this is an important change that was that we're implementing, the data that is submitted to the plans will include price data. That's another of the elements that Mr. Feinwatz talked about. It's the inclusion of price information along with the other information around services that are provided. That will allow us to have a better sense of not only the types of services that are being provided, but the level of payment that's associated with those services, so that we're able to report back that information to you to fulfill the final element of the governor's executive order, which is an annual comprehensive report on managed care, so that you have an understanding, a very, very clear and transparent understanding of how we're operating our programs. With that, I'll conclude and turn it back to Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Scott. Let me just say a few words about the UCARE donation, since that came up. First of all, let me say thank you to UCARE for doing this. I think it was the right thing to do, and it was unprecedented, and I want to acknowledge that. I certainly thought it was a donation. To be a repayment, you'd have to ask, someone would have to ask for it. And I still remember that Monday morning meeting when I saw my calendar that Nancy Feldman had just pushed her way through my good assistant to say, no, I really have to talk with the commissioner. And they came in my office and they said, we're going to donate $30 million from our reserves to the state. That was on March 14th. So I certainly thought about it that way. I was actually out in Baltimore meeting with CMS about some other matters on March 16th and 17th, so just later that week. And I remember telling CMS, I said, look, we got this donation, unprecedented in Minnesota. I want to tell you about it. We think it's a donation. We don't have to pay the federal share. We know you may disagree. If you do, let's sit down and talk about it. So we certainly, tried to be upfront about it, but also just appreciate, them stepping forward. We tried to notify folks about that. I know that, letters went to both of you as chairs and to the minority leads, and we've certainly been following up documenting this with CMS. So just let me maybe say a few words in conclusion, if I may. The changes that we have made in the past year, I believe, really constitute a great step forward in reforming our purchasing. and increasing our openness and accountability at the department. I think this is we've made a fundamental shift in the way we do business with the health plans. But we're not done. We're continuing the efforts this year by evaluating our competitive bidding process, looking at ways we can improve it in the future, and working with the help of counties and providers to develop improved healthcare delivery systems that will increase the quality and decrease the cost of care along the line, trying to create that third way. Looking at where we can use competitive bidding in the process, where there's enough competition. I think few people understand any more than, let me put it this way. Few understand the fiscal pressures of our current budget predicament and the effect on human services delivery better than those of us, especially in the leadership team at the Department of Human Services. But I know that many of you around that table join us in understanding both the complexity and the importance of the fiscal pressures but our need to provide critical services. But speaking for the department, I'll say that we certainly understand that today every public dollar is more precious than ever, and that in order to better serve the people of Minnesota, we need to be able to continue to do more with less. And that includes taking a hard look at how we pay for health care. I understand just in my conversations with many of you and with others that there may be interest in examining ways to bring more accountability and more transparency to this process. The governor did what he could in the executive order. I think there may be additional ways, and we strongly support those concepts. Concepts like, independent audits, certainly. Making sure that the state and plans can't use the same actuaries. We started putting that in our contracts, but having that a matter of law makes a lot of sense. And we also think that we need to do whatever we can to provide quick access to the encounter and pricing data, making sure it's both usable and accurate. So those are things that we would look forward to working with the legislature and others about. So once again, thanks for hearing us out, and we'll field questions later.
Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Leitz. And you finished early, so. Health plans like to come down for your 30 minutes, and I don't know who all you know to testify, you're free to go beyond the list you've submitted if you'd like to do that in your testimony. So, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourselves, and thank you for coming.
Chairman Abler, Chairman Gottwald, members of the committee, my name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. With me today is Jeff Barsh, Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations with Medica Health Plan. Medica is one of five members of the council that contract with the Department of Human Services to provide coverage and access for Minnesotans enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs. We were asked today to talk to you, share some facts about accountability and transparency of the HMOs in the administration of the Medicaid program. Last year on February 8th we were in, and I think we overwhelmed you with a box of information trying to let you know how much information we really supply, but we're not going to do that again. But Jeff is going to do is to walk you through some of the high points and highlights around areas that we are reporting on a regular basis. We want to focus on a few of those areas, and as I said, Jeff will talk you through those, and then we'll look forward to an opportunity to answer questions later.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Abel and Chairman Gottmold. Again, for the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medica. As Julie mentioned, I'm just going to talk about a couple highlights here. I think the department gave a nice overview, and then I think we'll be available for questions if members of the committee have them afterwards. The first thing I'd like to talk about is the fact that the HMOs in Minnesota, our financial information is independently audited, and that's done annually. That's a requirement in state law. That's a fact. State law requires that our financial information is independently audited. And there's a raft load of statute that describes the format in which the certified public accountant has to be qualified, attest to their independence, regulations that spell out whether or not they can work with us for other lines of business in order to make that happen. In addition to the annual independent audits that we're required to submit, we are audited by the Department of Commerce, Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as Minnesota Attorney General, has the ability to audit us as nonprofits. I just again like to state that all for the record. We are independently audited, and we are audited by a number of state and federal agencies. Those are facts. The second thing I'd like to talk about is the fact, as Mr. Leitz discussed, the HMOs are required to submit granular level encounter data on all of our Medicaid and other state public programs members to the Department of Human Services. State law and our contracts with the Department of Human Services spell out in great detail the manner in which we are required to submit that information. The guidance for how we are to submit that is also spelled out in great detail. That's publicly available on the Department of Human Services website. The information that we submit in the encounter data spells out very clearly for each of our Medicaid or state public program members who the member was, what the service was, where the service took place, who the provider was, how much we paid for that service, if it was a prescription drug, what the drug was, and where it was filled. Again, that information is submitted to the Department of Human Services monthly, is spelled out in our contracts and spelled out in state law. The last thing, or the third thing I'd like to talk about is just to remind the committee again that HMOs is a requirement of our licensure, are required to participate in our state public programs. When the state expanded the PMAP program statewide in 1996, I believe, that requirement went into law. So for every HMO that's licensed in the state, even if we want to operate only individual or group insurance, we have to participate with the state for our state public programs. Even in the counties where the competitive bidding process has now gone into place, we are required to submit a bid to participate in these programs in those counties. Last year, this committee and I think a Senate committee discussed whether or not to remove that requirement that we participate in the programs. You didn't act. But that requirement is still in place. What that means is we are bound by the rules set by the legislature and the Department of Human Services to participate in these programs, not just for these programs, but for our licensure in the state. Mr. Chairman, the 2008 Legislative Auditor's Report was mentioned earlier. I agree it's a good report. It's a good read. In reaction to that report in 2008, the legislature passed the law in response to that. Spelled out new requirements for how managed care plans and county-based purchasing plans report our administrative expenses, how we treat investment income, how to satisfy the information that we submit for quality, and that law also limited what the Department of Human Services could pay us under our contracts for administrative expenses. Then in 2009, the legislature passed a law requiring reporting of specific provider reimbursement information and required DHS to submit a report based on that information to the legislature. In 2009 was also when the state updated the independent auditing laws that are in place. That also passed the legislature in 2009. In 2010, the legislature passed a law further defining how administrative expenses for HMOs, not just for public programs, but in general, report our administrative expenses so that there's consistency in how those are reported across public programs. And then finally, as Mr. Leitz talked about, there was the executive order and the legislation passed in 2011 that again talks about how to manage care and county-based purchasing plans, submit information on administrative expenses, non-administrative expenses, and counter data, and some other information. Mr. Chairman, we comply with all these laws. In addition to the laws that were passed, Commissioner Jessen discussed the competitive bidding proposal last year. I can tell you as a health plan that lost a bid in six of seven counties, that was a real change, one that quite frankly our organization wasn't thrilled with. But as these programs move forward and as we had the discussion about competitive bidding last year, Mr. Chairman, I told you that these are the Department of Human Services programs. They're the state's programs for the legislature and the department to manage. And you can change those programs or alter the contracting arrangement in the manner that you think makes the best sense for the state of Minnesota. We think we're good partners for the state. We think we've been good partners for the state. We'd like to continue to be good partners for the state. But we do comply with the laws that are set forward by all of you. We're happy to do so moving forward. We're happy to answer any questions that this legislature or other people might have about information that should be reported to the department that is not being, and how that information that's getting to the department can be made available to all of you to make your decisions. Mr. Chairman, with that, I think I'll end my comments. And again, thanks for the time, and I'd be happy to answer questions when we get to that point.
Ms. Bruner, you want to continue?
No.
Oh, that's it. Okay. Well, thank you. And you have more time left, obviously, if you wanted to use it. Well, I think what we'll do now is assemble the five witnesses. If they would, Commissioner, are you comfortable sitting at the table and with Mr. Lights and Mr. Finewalks, if you want to come down? I didn't give our pages heads up about this, but we'll need three more chairs. There's some up here that aren't being used currently, if you want to come steal a couple of those. And so we'll move into some question time here, and I think we'll just continue our normal committee format and take a break at 2:15, and then I think we'll reconvene at 2:30, like we would normally do. We'll try to make that a time certain, just so people can, stretch their legs and so on. And while they're getting set up, I'll just offer my an oversight overview of this. I see three different topics coming out of this. I've been discussing transparency issues for at least 4 years, if not longer, and it's hard to not do that when you're sitting at these chairs up here. So none of this is new, and I've argued with the department about how they set rates, and is it cost plus, and Ms. Peed, and all those, and she remembers those discussions, I'm sure. Senator Berglund was part of this, and it goes way back. But I, to summarize, what I see is the three salient topics that have been brought forward by this and past discussions. One is this: the first thing about this rate setting, the GA piece and the medical assistance part, and which we had some testimony about that in the beginning, and not much reaction beyond that so far. And then the second part has to do with transparency and audits, and how do we know what's going on, and is that a reliable thing, that pot of discussion. And the third thing is reserves, and what's an appropriate amount of reserves for plans to have, and are they indeed at risk or not? To me, those are the three topics that I'm taking away from this. Not to tell you what else you can't take away, but that's just how I see it. And so since the panel is assembled, I'll take the first question. And about my question about the auditing, and the department is changing a bit, which I appreciate. I think Mr. Finewalks had some good points about, is there entanglement or not? And I don't know that. But we always wonder, what are we getting for our $7 billion of biennium? And it's federal money is ours, too. So can a couple of you, you can just comment as you like, about the audits. I just have a sense in my mind that the past audits weren't that worthwhile, and we didn't really learn a lot from that. And even though you submit boxes of information, Mr. Bartsch, I've heard that, and I believe it, and you gave us a box full, and it was a lot. I still have the box. Could have put it in pink ribbon today for the holiday. Has that been a worthwhile experience? Do the plans learn something? Does the department learn anything from that? Mr. Lights, do you find that you can't wait to read it and see what's new? And so is the new system that you're putting forward, is Commerce the place to do it? Should it be the state auditor doing it, or some third party we don't even know who they are? Can you comment about that, please? And I don't know who wants to go first. I can give all three groups a chance to comment.
Mr. Chair, Scott Lights from the department. I'll start with that. I think stepping back from our perspective, we felt that the audits that were being conducted provided information around the solvency levels of plans and other things that are important for us to know from a consumer perspective, a protection perspective. But the reason that the governor's executive order directed us in the direction that it did, which was really more around helping us to better understand whether the dollars were tying back to whether the financial statements were tying back to what the rate setting process had looked like, how we're allocating administrative expenses within those programs. Those were questions that weren't necessarily being answered by audits that had been occurring in the past. I think the health plans are audited on a lot of stuff. But those were salient questions that we wanted to know the answers. We were hearing questions from this body as well as from others in the community around this issue. I think that's the direction. That's why we wanted to go the direction that we did in the executive order. And then the third thing I would say related to that is, and this relates back to the encounter data piece of this, was to try for us to more fully maximize the use of that information to be able to get at a much more granular level an understanding of where the dollars are going. And I think that the way that we Part of the problem, I think, with the process that has occurred up to this point has been we get all this information. I may love it because I'm kind of a nerd and like to walk out on these things. But unless you're really into it, you don't understand necessarily what it means. And I think that's very much the point of the governor's final part of the executive order is now tell us what this all means. Produce an annual report that reports back to the legislature, reports back to stakeholders in the community, where the dollars are going in the system. What changes might be necessary? What do the contracts look like? What does that process look like this year? What do you expect to see in the coming year? So I think that is the approach that we've taken since coming in, has been to try to build on what's already there, but add to the pieces that we know people have been asking questions about.
Thanks. Mr. Feinwachs, do you want to go? Ms. Bruner, you want to go? Yeah, then Mr. Feinwachs.
Chairman Abler and members, a couple of things. First of all, the department or the council, the plans, have supported the direction that the department has taken under Commissioner Jessen. Being smarter purchasers of health care is something that the plans have been engaged in the commercial side of their business for years. And so having the state move into that, it seems absolutely reasonable, particularly in times of financial stress. One of the things that we've asked at plan level for years is, you saw that box last year. We kept saying, who looks at this stuff? Is anybody examining all these reports? And so the idea that the department is going to be looking at what's useful, looking at it in different ways, perhaps changing what they ask for so that we don't submit the same information to the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Commerce. All of the things that have happened to the plans in terms of reporting in the last decade have been additive. It's more and more and more. And all that does is push up administrative costs, which pushes up the cost of health care. So I think the opportunity to pause, take a look at looking at auditing in a different way, reporting in a different way, alignment between the three state agencies, which I understand is seriously under consideration right now, I think it's a great opportunity, and we would support that. We don't object to more audits because the plans are so audited right now. I mean, come on in. They have room set aside. There are auditors in the health plans every day of the year, one or two different, you know, a private auditor, CMS, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Health, or the DHS Michigan firm. There's somebody auditing in a health plan every day. So the idea that we would all have an opportunity to get smarter about doing that, we would support that. But at the same time, I would urge the department, and I've had conversations with the department about this, and I've talked about it in front of this committee before, is let's get smarter about the information that we're asking. I mean, if you submit the same pieces of data to three state agencies, but it's in slightly different formats, that doesn't make any sense at all. And I think that this administration is looking at how to do that kind of alignment.
And I know the MMB project is underway and has had some success about consolidating some of those. And I wonder who has to pay all the coffee for those auditors. Mr. Feinwalk, do you want to comment, please?
Chairman Abel and members, yes. My comments would be basically in two areas. First of all, I didn't finish my PowerPoint because of time, but for those of you who have it or have the last slide, and I'm going from memory, so don't hold me to it. The last slide in my presentation was, in fact, an email from someone at the Council of Health Plans. Oh, thank you. Which I believe said something to the effect that what Feinwachs is talking about is that nobody actually looks at every receipt and the underlying information, and he's right about that. And in fact, that's the problem here. The kinds of audits that we do here are largely based on summary documents, which are really incapable of audit. They are summaries prepared by the people who are being audited, and you can't really dig past the summary, sort of like if the IRS audited you and you gave them another copy of your tax return and said, there you go. Well, typically what they want to see is canceled checks and credit card receipts and the source documentation that led you to the conclusions and the numeric values that you're offering up in the summary documents or the tax returns. And that appears to be what we're lacking here. And I agree with Ms. Bruner. I think a great deal of what we've saddled the plans with in terms of reporting requirements is not useful and a waste of time. What I'm proposing is true, independent, third-party audits, which is audits conducted by people who are not state agencies, who accept neither money from plans nor providers, and who do this kind of work solely for government and enforcement agencies, and basically have no reason to give you anything other than the straight scoop.
Thank you. We'll other questions now, and I'd like this. This is, I know this is not a partisan matter. I have three on my side of the aisle with questions. I'd rather go back and forth. So, Representative Huntley, it'd be after. Why don't you go first, then I'll go to Representative Coonhagen.
I have a couple of questions, I think, for either Scott Leitz or Commissioner Jessen, Mr. Chair. And one of the things I'm most interested in, and I don't think we ever get to it, is do we really measure the health outcomes of any of these people? Or do we just look at how much dollars we spent, how much went into administration, and how much went to some provider? Do we actually get data on whether we're improving the health of these people?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm so glad you asked that question, because when we were talking about these financial audits, I wanted to jump in and say, can we talk about audits about outcomes and how we're doing? And one of the good things that we're doing at the department and have done, I think was last year the first year, Scott? I think just last year was the first year, is we've contracted with Minnesota Community Measurement to come in and help us and look at our data and to say, okay, let's compare how we're doing on these key factors. And we'll look at different ones, different years, you know, and compare how our public program enrollees are doing, and not just, you know, to some mythical standard, but versus the private enrollees, as well as where we think they should be. So how many of our kids on public programs are getting vaccinated? How many of the people on our public enrollees getting optimal diabetes care? You know, and we'll and we can do that now, actually, not just across the board, but by clinics. We can go in and be able to say, this clinic is doing, like, I just gave an award recently to, I think it was the Litchfield Clinic, exceptional award on a number, on treating, for meeting these quality measures for our public enrollees. So we are really starting to make a big effort towards that. I think in this third way, I've talked about contracting with providers to and creating, you know, getting them to be responsible for the health outcomes as of this population they serve, as well as if they reach those health outcomes, being able to share in any efficiencies and any cost savings also really kind of goes to that issue. Yes, we need to look at the dollars, but we also need to say, are we getting what we're paying for?
Representative Huntley, do you have two
questions? Mr. Yeah. Chair, then I have another question. Are our rates that we pay the health plans, are those certified every year by CMS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, yes.
So, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner Leitz, that means that they have approved the rates that we're paying to the health plans. And I don't want to get in an argument about actuarial soundness, but they approve those rates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, yes.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
And thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'll have a comment at the end.
Okay. We'll put you at the, maybe like at 4 o'clock or something. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I got several questions, and just appreciate the responses from the three different groups here. I spent about half my legislative life last year on this issue, and it's awful slippery, it seems. But and I also authored separate pieces of legislation to try to get at some of the questions that are here, too. But one of the things that concerned me that I learned through this, I was given a graph from one of the plans, and it showed that between 1998 and 2010, funding for the PMAP program went up by 105%. So that's about an 8 to 9% increase per year. But when you looked at the provider reimbursement rates, they stayed flat, and in case of specialists, they actually went down in 2009 and 2010. Now, the explanation that I got from the HMOs is that while our enrollment increased, and that's why the provider reimbursement stayed flat. Of course, it's a big concern of mine because obviously when providers are losing money on these reimbursement rates, they try to make it up in other areas, especially private insurance, and ultimately that drives their rates up for the rest of us that have private insurance. So my one additional observation, I met with some county health workers in my district, and they could remember that prior to the HMO plans administering the PMAP program, when it came straight from the state, they used to get increases on their services on a pretty regular basis. But now they haven't seen increases for years on their reimbursement rate. So my question is, since funding has gone up 105%, and yet providers' reimbursement has stayed flat for over 10 years, is it valid to say that the increase in enrollment has actually produced that result? Or should providers be seeing some type of increase on their reimbursement? And I guess I'll start with Mr. Feinwalk, and I'd like all three areas to respond.
Mr. Feinwalk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think you've touched upon an interesting issue. There appears to be no parity between increases in terms of money poured into the program and what the providers actually receive. The question that you're asking, or at least that I perceive you to be asking, is really a critical question. What's the biggest cost driver in the healthcare system? And in order to answer that question, we have to take a long, hard look at the middleman or broker to see what costs they're adding and what value, if any, they're adding. Because it's quite possible that, in fact, the HMOs are one of the largest cost drivers in the system.
Commissioner, do you want to? Okay, go ahead,
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple of things. Well, I'm all for looking at cost drivers, I must say. I do think when we look at those overall numbers, we do have to also look at enrollment data. And, you know, you got the chart from the plan, so I'm not sure just what you're looking at, but let me just give you a couple of numbers I think that are important. You know, I just stepped back, for example, and looked at the enrollment in our MA for Families and Kids program just since the recession. We have over 100,000 more people on that program since 2008. Just astonishing. But here's one thing that I think shed some light on this. I just looked at this national study. It was a national study that looked at cost per enrollee in a Medicaid program. And they basically were taking out the enrollment ups and downs and just say, let's look at this across a number of years. And so I, of course, dive in and say, well, where's Minnesota? Because they had basically a national average cost per enrollee. And now this isn't just health plans, so this is all across all our programs. And in Minnesota, and I'm doing this by memory, but I'm pretty sure my numbers are right, between 2004 and 2009, the national average increase per enrollee was 2.3%. Minnesota's cost per enrollee was 1.7%. So we are actually below the national average, and I think that is, frankly, because we have kept, I think often we do need to do more for providers. So I'm very sympathetic to that. You know, actually, during the period of time, 98 to 2004, we were twice the national average. So we were significantly above the national average. But most recently, during the period of time you're talking about, we've been less when you look at it on a per enrollee. But I do agree that we need to look at this, these provider payment issues. And that's one of the reasons that we are very happy that just starting last year in the 2011 contract year, we're getting the data from the plans, the encounter, and price data so that we can analyze it and hopefully put that in this transparency report Assistant Commissioner Lights referred to so we can start to track. How much are, we'll do it in a summary form. We don't want to be, anti-competitive here since I'm promoting competition. But we'll be state, okay, how much are the plans, paying this category of provider? Are there differences, big differences between plans? How is that changing across the years? That is the sort of information we very much want to get at.
Mr. Bartsch or Ms. Gooner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, I think the first thing to think about when you're asking your question is that the payments to the health plans are a payment for an aggregate, for all of the services, for all of the members. So it encapsulates both utilization, enrollment, and the price itself. When you're looking at the specific fee paid to provider for a specific service, that's just one fee for one service for one provider. So the fee schedule has stayed relatively the same, but both the enrollment and the utilization has gone up dramatically.
Okay.
And the health plans independently financial audited financial statements, you know, reconcile that. You can also look at what little claims information is submitted from providers. The hospitals, I'll give them credit, they're one of the only provider organizations. They submit a wealth of information in their hospital annual reports. And if you just look at the revenue that they're reporting from the prepaid medical assistance programs over a period of time, you'll see those rates increase over a period of time, even though the specific fee schedule itself has not increased. Again, the factors are both enrollment and utilization.
Upson Grunhagen, one more question, then we'll just, there'll be time late after the break to get another one in later.
Okay, next question is on the reserves. Okay, Mr. Feinwalk's position is they're excessive, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, but when I talk to the plans, they say they're mandated by law to provide these services, and if there's an interruption or decrease in funding from the state in any way, they need reserves to fall back on. So because they're mandated by law, they have to have these reserves, and I guess I just like the same type of response. Mr. Feinwalk, what's your position on the mandated reserves?
Mr. Feinwalk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, as we discussed earlier, these arrangements, these contracts, have no real risk associated with them. And so the only theoretical risk is that the state of Minnesota will cease to exist from 1 year to the next before you can get all your money back. So now, given the current environment, Mr. Chairman, I agree with you that now perhaps more than ever before, it's a possibility, but I think we can all agree or at least hope that it's an extremely remote possibility. And therefore, the amount of the reserves do indeed seem excessive, given the nature of the actual risk.
I'd like the department and the...
Oh, they're going to. Mr. Bartsch, do you want to comment, or which of you two?
Do you guys have a comment?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenbacken, this is one of those moments where I first have to say I'm not the Commissioner of Commerce. And that is really kind of in the Commissioner of Commerce's area to look at the appropriateness and level of health plan reserves. I would say, though, that, I mean, from my perspective as the Commissioner of Human Services, I hope you heard me saying this during my testimony, I want to do everything I can to negotiate better deals so that we aren't increasing their reserves more with public dollars than they are with private dollars, which I found to be very troubling.
And Commissioner, I just thought of a kind of a rule we can make up here. You know, I don't, there's like a lot of health plan people, for instance, and so if one of you wanted to phone a friend to answer instead of you, that would be fine. There's only one Mr. Feinwalk, so I don't think you're kind of here. But like if the Commissioner just said she couldn't answer the question about reserves, after the break I'd like to hear from, maybe somebody from Commerce can come and tell us that question. And that somebody, maybe if they're listening, can get somebody here for the 2:30 hour to have that be one of their first questions. Mr. Bartsch, do you want to go on there? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, health plans and all insurance companies, whether it's property, casual, health, are required to carry reserves. The reason is you're accepting risk for the entity that signs a contract with you, and regulators want to make sure that you have the financial stability to actually cover the risk that you're accepting. We're required to have reserves, but reserves are a commonplace situation for any nonprofit organization, local units of government. Some of us hope they would have been for the state of Minnesota or the federal government. That's not the case. But our reserves are there to protect our consumers, whether they are a state public program consumer or a commercially insured consumer, someone who buys individual insurance or group insurance. So the reserves for our organization protect the risk associated with all lines of business. Not just one line of business. Our reserves are not excessive. I don't think that an evaluation of our reserves would be excessive if you looked at them as a measure of risk-based capital, which is how they're measured by the Department of Commerce, or if you applied what used to be the state's measure of appropriate reserves. They used to measure reserves on a months of expense basis. So HMOs were required to carry between one but not more than 3 months of expense. I think if you look at all the HMOs, at least with their 2010 financial statements, were all within that corridor that used to exist. So no, I don't believe the HMOs or the insurance companies in this state are excessively reserved.
Thank you. You can follow up later. Representative Liebling? Oh, did you just want to comment about that?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just got one and a half more questions, so whenever you can fit me in.
Yeah, on the list we have Liebling, McDonald, Hosh, Gottwald, Lane, Quam, Mack, Barrett, and Grunhagen. So there's plenty of time. We put a lot aside for this. So Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to go back to the issue about the $30 million donation from UCARE. And, that was a donation. Obviously, they weren't obligated to make that repayment. But it does bring us back to the underlying question that Mr. Feinwachs talked about, which is that and I'm looking at this letter that he gave us from UCARE to Senator Hahn, and I do kind of vaguely remember receiving this myself. You know, we were all very happy that there was some extra money for the budget. But it does bring us to the question that Mr. Feinwachs raised about if indeed we had essentially overpaid, and I understand that was a contract, and you know, you can't undo your contracts. But we'd essentially overpaid the plans because we were paying them for our GAMC program, which, of course, cost a lot more money. And then that program went away. It says in this letter that historically DHS rates set for general assistance medical care resulted in health plan losses which were offset by higher medical assistance payments. When GAMC moved out of managed care in mid-year 2010, medical assistance rates were not lowered to reflect this overpayment. So I assume that affected not just UCARE. UCARE is telling us about it in this letter. It must have affected the other plans. And I'm just wondering, maybe they just kept it that year. Those who didn't volunteer it back didn't give it back to us. But I'm wondering if that's been accounted for going forward. And also, I guess I'd like to know what the plans have to say about that, other than UCARE. And also, how was that number? I don't know if there's anybody from UCARE here. Maybe Ms. Bruner knows. But, you know, how that particular number was arrived at. Is that... Does that number represent, I'm just curious about if we got $30 million from them, should we have gotten, is that the right number? And should we have gotten something from the other plans on a voluntary basis perhaps, but if not, going forward, have we made that adjustment to account for the lower costs or to account for the fact that that program isn't there anymore?
Good question. Ms. Bruner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I can't comment on the decision or the calculation that UCARE went through. That was not something that was done through the council. The health plans didn't talk with each other about it. I do believe that Agita Wooster is here, and she may be able to give you some additional details.
This is part of the phone-a-friend feature. Welcome, Ms. Wooster, to the committee.
I'm Gita Wooster, UCARE's Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Marketing, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do want to reference that there were several points in that letter, so when I talk about how we determined the $30 million, it wasn't just our reference to the fact that the GAMC program was closed down. We did talk about the difference in the patient population that was in the program, the fact that we did a lot with different initiatives for medical costs and administrative costs. But what we simply did was look at what the expected target was for the net income for the program under the DHS contract, and then the amount of money over that our health plan made, and the $30 million was the result of that. So it was very simple math in that perspective.
Representative Liebling, you want to follow up?
Okay, thank you,
or
Mr.
More
Chair.
People, you
well, yeah, I guess, thank you. And I guess my question then is, you know, more to going to the other plans, you know, whether they didn't think, too, that perhaps they had netted extra money for that year and should perhaps offer some of it back. I mean, surely the other plans were aware that UCARE had done this, and yet nobody jumped up and said, me too, me too. And then I guess I'd like to know going forward whether this was going to be accounted for in some way.
Perhaps labeling the room is full of people from different plans. So if you want me to invite one down, I'll be happy to invite one. Take your pick, or do you want Mr. Bartz to go?
That was my
okay.
thinking. Maybe he'd like to phone some friends.
Okay. There. He wants to get away.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I can only answer for Medica. I can't answer for the other health plans on this. But no, Medica did not feel at the time UCARE made their contribution to the state that our earnings from our public programs warranted us giving a donation to the state. I think it's just as simple as that. They made that decision independently on their own. And the reasons for that are theirs.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Mr. Barsh, then what they're saying in this letter about the fact that the GAMC had traditionally, historically, resulted in losses that were offset by medical assistance payments. Are you saying that that's not the case?
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Liebling, no, not at all. I think the fact that no health plan, I think, ever made a positive margin off of the general assistance medical care program is not only common knowledge, but it's been discussed in this legislature numerous times. I mean, the legislative auditor in the report in 2008 very clearly demonstrated that there is no margin attached to the rates that the state produces for general assistance medical care, but they do attach a margin for the medical assistance in Minnesota care program. So, no, that's, I mean, I think everyone's known that. I think when the general assistance medical care program went away, it's our belief that the department did adjust the rates accordingly and move forward. UCARE had a different interpretation of that.
Absolutely, blame.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't belabor it, but I guess I'd just like to ask the department then to respond to that. You know, was there an adjustment and going forward from there, given that this loss leader was removed?
Mr. Lights. On a phone a friend.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, without getting too into the weeds on this, essentially the department, as I understand it, prior to the competitive bidding world, when we were doing rate setting and GAMC existed as a program, there is a requirement under federal law that you actually base federally matched program dollars, the rates that you set for those programs, on the costs and populations of those programs. And so my understanding is that the rates that were set for GAMC, traditionally being only a state-only program, were low. And I think it is agreed by everybody that they were likely below cost. But that's a separate issue from the PMAP rates, which are really set on the costs of the medical assistance program and the enrolled population for that program. That's my understanding of how that's been dealt with in the past.
Person Liebling, are you?
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, well, I guess I'm hearing two different things, and I'm hearing Mr. Lights say something that's very different than what UCARE told us in this letter. And I, from what I understand, that's how it's supposed to be done. But the question is whether that's how it was actually being done. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
I'm going to call Mr. Feinwachs. He wants to say something. Let me say something else. Now, I'm recognizing that the administration being representative in DHS now is not the administration who was then, but Mr. Lights was in the Department of Health and has some knowledge of this anyway, but it wasn't. Or Children's, and then Children's, and whatever, even everywhere. But so some of the questions I know are beyond the scope of the witnesses, but if you want to know about rates, we can actually have discussions about those. There's adequate staff that DHS that is still working there that did some of the stuff. If we don't drag Mr. Hoffman over some other day or talk about that. Okay, anyway, he's busy today. But anyway, Mr. Feinwachs.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I know that that the panel here is supposed to provide answers, but I want to leave you with a question to contemplate. If everyone agrees that the General Assistance Medical Care Program is being subsidized with a higher Medicaid rate, the real question is, do we all agree the federal government knew that this was happening? Because that appears to be the question.
Well, thank you. I think this is a good time for a break. I do want to acknowledge a couple of just a couple of guests in the audience. Well, we're going to what?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you consider perhaps just segueing right into the next meeting since we're all seated here ready to go so we can just continue on?
Well, we announced that we're going to take a break at halftime. So
I realize that. I'm just asking if you'd consider that.
Yeah, I'm not doing it. So. I think people need a break. But let me just acknowledge Representative Bunn is in the audience. Mr. Nobles is here. I want to tell my mom Happy Valentine's Day. pretty good. And I'm about to yield the gavel to Representative Gottwalt, and we'll be reconvening. Come back at 2:30, and so we're in recess.
I did not.
We are back from recess, and continuing with our hearing on government program and HMO transparency and rate setting. And so, once again, I'll thank our testifiers for being here and any of the helplines that they may be calling in. I have been asked to mention, and this was not by anybody from partisan staff or anything like that, but in fact from the facilities people, the sergeant, I think, that we, at least with the previous hearing, we were almost at room capacity. So there was a request to have people, you know, it's kind of like church. Everybody sits in back and the front pews are open. So the front pews are open. Please move to the front so that there's room for people in back. And then if we start getting full again, we have overflow seating, and I believe there's televised and audio. So if you want to observe this, you can do that in room 181 of this building, so one floor down from here. So again, now move forward, allow room for people to sit in here, and then as we fill up, there's overflow seating and video in room 181. I'm Representative Steve Gottwald, Chair of the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, and so this joint hearing now continues. And what we're going to do is continue with questions from committee members as they return.
Mr. Chair.
And just a moment, Representative Grunhagen. We will try to go back and forth between Republican and DFL questions just to kind of underscore the nonpartisan, bipartisan nature of this this hearing on transparency. So with that, Representative McDonald was next, and I see him returning to his seat. So Representative McDonald, you're up. In the meantime, Representative Grunhagen, did you have a question? Or?
No, I was just going to say if the Representative McDonald wasn't here, then I was willing to take his place and ask my question.
Okay. Well, he is.
Representative
McDonald.
Grunhagen would like to jump ahead of me, and I could be next. That'd be great because I'll collect my thoughts after that break.
Well, we actually have a list. Representative Grunhagen has had his turn, and we'll go back. If we get through the list, we'll go back. So I'm not trying to play favorites here at all. If you're not ready, we can go to the next in the list and come back to you. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the testimony, I heard a desire not to report the same information to and then three departments listed. I can understand that. I hope we're reporting the same data, and I'm wondering if utilization of some of the newer analytical tools to be able to make sure that you write a query and you just update those queries might be the route to go. And that makes it easier for when you're doing audits. And I've had people come to me who are familiar with the auditing of, say, pharmacists and dentists, and they have their auditors have tools that run through the data, pick out, you know, they want examples of this type, they'll go through and pick out random, but also picks out anything that's flagged as abnormal. And I'm thinking that there's a huge amount of data that the departments ought to look for, you know, some of these analytics tools in order to better leverage the time in auditing so that you can actually go down to the details. You know, if you have to pick up the papers and look at, and that way at least you have a continuum of the oversight and then avenues of details, and we don't let something, you know, skip and miss, because a lot of businesses have saved a great deal of money by using these tools and time. But I am concerned that providers seem to maybe be taking the hit when the plans are sort of guaranteed up to a certain amount of administrative overhead and profit. Mm-hmm. I would think that if you added, I wrote down 100K, but you said over 100K increased participants, that if you've got the same overhead, that you would be more efficient. And be nice to see a trending of improved efficiency, and I was wondering if any of that data is available, because, you know, frankly, if I increase 10 or 20% and I'm doing a business, I don't, you know, I've got some efficiencies and I don't have to charge my customers as much. So can you talk about how you look at those efficiencies and hopefully drive down the administrative costs?
Maybe that's a question for both Commissioner Jessen and perhaps Mr. Light. So, Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Plum, thank you for that question. At DHS, I think that we will be perhaps the heaviest users of this in these new data analytic master contracts, you know, because those are some of the very things we're looking at. How can we use the data analytics tools to look at, to help us do that first cut to say, okay, where should we focus our, where are the red flags, where should we focus our attention? And so I agree we should do that. Though I also think that there's a point to, if you're having to file basically the same report with three different agencies, you know, there is some duplication there that I think the MMB's task force really should look at. Because it's not only do you have the plans doing it three times, you also have state, three different state agency folks doing it. So I think that that's a legitimate concern. And on the lower administrative cost, I mean, that's something that I think we will look at again with this new data that we're getting as a result of last year's legislation where we get more of the administrative data. But I would say that in the budget that was passed, it was in the governor's budget passed by the legislature, I think it was very much a bipartisan effort, last year, we lowered the maximum amount that health plans can charge for administrative costs. And we lowered that to where I think it's the lowest in the nation. And part of that, at least in our thinking, was we do have more people. There should be some efficiencies. But we'll certainly look at that again.
Okay. Representative Quam, any follow-up? Okay. We'll go to Representative Hosh. And just again, for members who came back, we're going to continue with the going back and forth between DFL and Republican to kind of underscore the nonpartisan, bipartisan nature of the hearing. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, this definitely shouldn't be a partisan issue. And it's, you know, sometimes I have to kind of reconcile some, you know, some of the inconsistencies that we all face as elected members, because and this was one issue that I think does that when it comes to how do we contract out essentially government services to a pseudo private entity, and then what is an appropriate level of oversight, of management, of regulation. And with a lot of the concerns that are placed today, you know, we shouldn't be frustrated with the players involved because of a lack of understanding or clarity. We should almost be frustrated with ourselves, because we've been asking these questions quite a bit. I hope that we have more than just legislative hearings on this issue, but actually start talking about ideas. What direction do we want to go? I think there's a lot of potential bipartisan agreement in that area. And also try to reconcile what we've done in the past. I mean, just as recently as the last legislative session, not only did we try to clamp down on, you know, some of the HMO concerns that we have, but we expanded the use of our contracting with HMOs when we allowed for the enrollment in the special needs basic care for the disability population in HMOs. That's not a bad thing, but we still have to be able to answer questions. You know, when we just talk numbers, I want to caution using numbers saying, oh, well, you know, our PMAP payments have gone up this percentage over a number of years, because in healthcare, it's always more complicated than what is met at face value. We have to consider utilization, we have to consider enrollment growth, and we have to consider medical inflation, which is significantly different than just inflation. And these are all things that we should be asking and talking about. And, you know, this theoretical black box, how big is it? And we don't know that. I hope now that there's next steps beyond today. You know, we've got a packed room right now for the hearings. We had TV cameras. I'm assuming the room won't be quite so packed if we start talking the details and the nitty-gritty of things. It's not as attractive of a political issue, but it's something that we've got to be doing. And we spend $3 billion a year when it comes to public enrollees in healthcare. We have gone down a system in which like it or not, we have taken government services and we have contracted them out. And I don't think we have enough regulation and oversight of that. There's ideas on the table. I hope we can consider them regardless of who is the author of the bills, if it's Republican or Democrat. And I hope you do that, Mr. Chair. That's just what I wanted to say. And I'm glad to hear kind of the direction that the questions have gone with today, because this hasn't been finger-pointing. If anything, we should point the finger back at us and say it's time for us to act.
Representative Hosh, I appreciate those comments. And just a bit in response to your request, I think that's exactly right. Our committees are charged with doing our legislative responsibility, and I know there is legislation already jacketed. There's legislation, I believe, legislators on both sides of the aisle who have ideas for improved transparency in government programs in the Health and Human Services area. And I know Commissioner Jessen and I have talked about some of this, Mr. Leitz and others. And so I think we will see substance coming forward this session. In fact, that would be my hope coming away from this hearing. It's one thing to kind of do some fact-finding, but then it's our responsibility to do something about it. I would agree. Thank you. Representative McDonald, are you ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm ready.
Right.
I'd like to address one of Mr. Feinwalk's emails that he showed us as testimony, in which it said, Commissioner Justin said that there's a good chance of keeping all this money. It must be characterized as a donation. If it's a refund, then the feds clearly get half. So the question is this. Commissioner Justin, you said earlier in your testimony that you believed it was a refund. And if that's the case, since when is a refund considered a donation, or since when is a donation considered a refund when it's paid by the Minnesota taxpayers? So I wondered if you could clarify the statement that it must be characterized as a donation, and if it's not, then it should be half should be paid back by the to the feds. And then also, is Karen Pede here?
I don't believe she is. I don't believe she is, no.
So perhaps someone could answer why she said that if you can't keep a secret, you must leave the room. What is the secret? Is that the $30 million? And that's my question.
Okay. Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I think perhaps you misheard my testimony, or it's possible I misspoke, but I said that I very much thought this was a donation, that they appeared, I didn't ask for this money, they appeared in my office, UCARE did, and told me about the donation. When I saw the, I think the email, and this was just a data practice request, they asked for all my emails related to this, and I turned them over. It was when I was looking at a draft press release, and I was trying to clarify that we should characterize this in our press release as a donation. So from a kind of federal relations perspective, if it's a donation, then we have a reasonable argument that as a donation, the state should be able to keep all $30 million of it. If it's some sort of, we ask for the money, it's a refund, you know, those sorts of things, then because the federal government, you know, pays for half of this, then we should be turning half of that back to the feds. And that was why I said, I understand that while the state, I thought the state had a reasonable position because it came as a donation, that it was, and we should be able to keep all $30 million of it. You know, understanding that that was not some clear-cut decision, I told CMS about it, you know, and, you know, was just tried to be very transparent with them that we'd received this, this is how it came to us, this is how we're characterizing it. Happy to discuss them if they've thought otherwise. So I'm concerned that there was another part of your question. Oh, you asked about Karen Pete. She is not here. She's no longer working in that part of the department. She's working, and can I say, she's a 25-year employee of the department and now doing a good job working our continuing care area. But she's not here. You know, she, as I read those deposition pages, and I didn't see them until last week either, you know, I think she said she didn't recall saying that. So I'm that's my recollection of Mr. Feinwalk's exhibits, but, you know, I wasn't in the department then, neither was Mr. Leitz, so I just don't think we're in a position to comment on that one way or the other.
Representative McDonald?
Yes, my understanding that UCARE is a public program, is that correct?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, UCARE is an HMO, that does business, that specializes in doing business for public programs. They do both Medicare and Medicaid programs generally. But, you know, there are people from UCARE here who will know a lot more, and perhaps Ms. Bruner is, you know, is better able to answer that question about UCARE's business than I am.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Well, let me just get to the point.
Go ahead. And,
yep. I don't want to, you know, beat around the bush. I think we have a very delicate situation where if there's $30 million that are overpaid, we must not be calling a donation. If it is a donation, fine, then correct me and I'll keep my mouth shut. But if it's an overpayment by the taxpayers, by no means should we pretend that it's a donation to the state of Minnesota when we paid our hard-earned tax monies for it to make sure that the population that we want to be treated should be treated and taken care of by our health care providers. So if I'm wrong, correct me, but it's no donation. Is giving back money that was overpaid. And if I'm wrong, correct me today. And then also, I still have not been answered if it is a refund, should the feds get clearly get half, like the email says?
Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, you know, from my perspective, they characterized it as donation. You know, when I looked at the contracts, I didn't see any reason under the contracts that they had to pay it back to us. So that was, but UCARE would know more about why they characterized it that way, but I didn't see any legal obligation for them that they had to pay it back to us. If they had to pay it back to us, then clearly it would be, you know, whether you call it a refund or, you know, some other payment, then, you know, the Fed should get half of that. And as I've said, I think I've tried to make clear, Representative McDonald, I'm the first to say that there is not some sort of crystal clear answer to this question about whether half of this should go back to the federal government or not. I think we have a reasonable position.
Representative McDonald, I think Ms. Worcester from UCARE is here and could perhaps shed a little more light on this too. Ms. Worcester, thank you, or welcome back again to the committee if you want to kind of state your name for the record and who you represent. Okay.
I'm Gita Worcester, UCARE's Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Marketing. You know, when you write things, sometimes you are not as clear as you wish you were. So we characterized what we were doing as a donation when we brought the concept to the commissioner in her office. And we believed that the decision for how the money could then be allocated, where the check should be sent, would be something determined by the Department of Human Services and, if appropriate, with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. I do want to clarify the use of our word overpayment. As I said, we talked through several different reasons that there was additional money at the end of the day in our bottom line. And we looked at all products together in state public programs that didn't have a Medicare connection and determined that we had additional money at the end of the day in 2010. So probably the word overpayment isn't very artful in how we were using it here, and I realize it's being used in this conversation as though we were being very specific with it, and we were not. We didn't have losses as a result of the fact that General Assistance was closed down. And that was what we were trying to get across in the letter.
Very good. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, indulge me here. I have a few things. first of all, I want to say that I think everybody up there has agreed that it's no problem to have an independent third-party audit. I do have a bill, House File 2241, now introduced to suggest that every single year that they do a contract, January 1st, part of the contract is that they agree to an independent, totally independent, third-party audit of that year at the end of the year, or the end of the contract. And it's very strict in sense of what that means as far as independent, because we want it truly independent. So if we do have agreement on that with all the entities, as has been said, I even heard the words, paraphrased as bring it on. and I do believe that the administration is in favor of that kind of approach too. So let's do it. Let's get this simply. We need the data. We want it to be independent. Here's one of the things we can do right away. just get that into next year's contract. But so the questions or the comments I have now would relate to the fact that we don't always know the data, and I would hope that some of this would come out of an independent third-party audit. I will comment first on the reserves, because I did, when I first came to the legislature, that's one of the first things I did, is address what I thought was something that needed to be addressed, a cap on the reserves. We had taken that off in 04, and they had gone up and up and up and up. And so I thought, let's be reasonable here. Let's put, I learned all about risk-based capital, RBC rates, to put it on, and I came up with something, and I presented it, and the person from the Department of Commerce said, oh, no, no, we don't want any cap at all. We want the reserves to be just as high as they can go, because the more, the better. And that was the answer from Commerce. So, but that's not really the case here, because for one thing, they don't need to be. The risk-based capital actually is a formula that builds in the actual risk in that particular entity and sets a bottom line, and then a percentage above that is to what would be very, very comfortable considering the exact risk of that entity plus the times plus everything that you can imagine into the risk-based capital amount. So by setting it up at a few hundred risk-based capital, right now I would suggest 400 risk-based capital, we would know that, first of all, there wouldn't be a problem with risk, and second of all, we know that, in fact, a good percentage of the amount that the health the HMOs have is not any risk at all. They're just simply third-party administrators to the money we give them, and then they spend them. So there's not the risk, as somebody said here, unless the state goes bankrupt. But just looking at that, let's just assume for a moment that we did address it all as a 400% risk-based capital. My understanding is that according to the numbers that we have now for the reserves that are out there, we have, if we gave everybody 400% risk-based capital, we would have $800 million excess. $800 million excess over and above the 400% risk-based capital. To me, that is an example of how we are not being cost-effective in the taxpayers' money given to these programs, given to these plans to do these programs. It's just something else that needs to be looked at. I will leave that at that and go to my next subject, which is provider payments. We hear constantly about providers being uncomfortable with the amount of money that they are getting to do the jobs that they need to do, the actual doctor payments to the doctors and providers. Not only do they negotiate with the health plans, the HMOs, to the health plans negotiate with them to bring down costs, but also we as a legislature reduce their rates. And I have the House Research for Medical Assistance here. It's just to put out October 2011. And here's list after list of payments for basic care services reduced by 1.5% for fiscal year 10 and 11. 4.5% here. Physicians and professional services, 3%. Outpatient hospital facility, 5%. On and on and on. We, as the legislature, reduce the rates that the providers get. So they're getting reduced by their negotiation through the plans. They're getting reduced by the legislature. So the providers that actually are the ones that are doing the job are getting cut. And I think that if we graphed how much the providers get, that graph would be pretty flat. But the amount that we are actually putting into the health plan seems to go like this, seems to go on an upward flow. And I just need to ask about that, I guess, is to, it can't purely be enrollment, because one of the things we do with health plans is cut people off. We say, okay, we're not going to provide to people who have a certain level of income. We raise their already low level of income that we allow and say, well, we'll allow even less income to them. So we cut people off these programs. I don't know. So why, and this is an ongoing thing over many years, that the amount we put in goes up, and yet the amount that comes out the other end to the providers, which is where the money should be going, like we say, 85% of the money we give to a school district goes into staff, it goes into teachers, because that's what they do, that's what it's about. And the money that goes into this goes into providing for health care services for people. That's what it's about. So why is what's coming out the other end fairly flat and what's going in keeps rising? I just throw that out there as a question, then I would have a comment after that.
Mr. Barsh.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lane, I'll address your second question first and then try to address your first, or your first question second. In terms of the increased payments to the HMOs and then the following outflow of payments to providers, if you track the aggregate money to the HMOs and the aggregate money that's paid out to providers, they increase at the same slope. What stays constant down in terms of doesn't increase is the specific rate for each service, and I think that was similar to Representative Grunhagen's comment earlier. So the state, through the Medicaid fee schedule, which is what they base the contract with the HMOs on, may only pay 25 cents per specific service. That has stayed constant over time. But over time, we have provided more and more of those services to providers, so the amount they receive in revenue is more than 25 cents. It grows at the same level of increase that we get as payments overall. The second part of your question, which was on reserves, first I want to disagree with some of the statements that Mr. Feinwalk stated earlier in terms of the health plans are not at risk. There are years in which our overall losses for state, we have losses for our state public programs. That includes Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and previously General Assistance Medical Care. We are at risk in those years. We do not get made whole. So we do carry the risk when we sign those contracts with the state. Secondly, you mentioned the appropriateness of reserves around 400%. I'm not sure what that is in terms of months of reserves, but that's about a month and a half, I think. The state used to require Blue Cross to carry at least 2 months in reserves. I can't imagine why we would start setting a cap on reserves that was below what we used to consider a minimum. Again, those dollars are there to protect the members that we insure so that whatever happens, increased claims costs, not receiving payment from one entity or another, that there is money in the bank to pay the claims. And the two states I know of that have put a higher level on risk-based capital, I believe one's at 1,000, I believe the other's at about 800% of RBC. It's not that we're opposed to having a conversation about what might be an appropriate limit for reserves. I think we've had that conversation in the past. We have it again. But it needs to be based on what is an appropriate risk for an insurer to carry and what's the appropriate amount of reserves for them to hold in order to protect that risk.
Representative Lane.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I would disagree that going back to the monthly rates makes any sense because the risk-based cap, that's just simply a number. We spent this much, therefore we have to have a couple months worth there. The risk-based capital builds in the risk. Monthly is just a number. It doesn't say anything to do with the risk whatsoever. That's why it's there. The risk-based capital is actually a number that builds in the actual risk, not just a number that we happen to spend before. It doesn't mean anything about risk, so I would disagree with you on that. And you say that you are at risk to spend the money because things can go down. But you can sort of like, it's sort of like my checkbook. I may have less coming in this year, so I have to make sure that there's something in the checkbook to cover this week or this month. I have to have something in the checkbook to cover it. But I know that when the check comes again, it's going to take care of that. And you will be made whole the following year because part of your negotiations is to cover what you paid last year. So there isn't that kind of risk of... I'm speaking very simplistically. I understand you see you sitting up, but there is a part of the formula that we used is what have you spent in the last 3 years? What has it been? Okay, let's go up from there. And when you say that the providers get the same amount for service, that's what their job is, doing that service, and they get the same amount for service year after year after year. Do they not have any inflation to cover? Does their paper not cost more? Do their salaries not cost more for their staff? Why do they get the exact same amount for service year after year after year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lane, the state has not increased the fee schedule for providers.
Okay.
In fact, as you stated earlier, you've reduced the payments to providers.
Okay. Then I would lead to my thank you, Mr. Chair. My last comments is just that if we have Commerce, Department of Health, and the Department of Human Services all involved in this, and everybody says, well, it's their job, it's this part is their job, and nobody's really clear on how it works, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of clarity around how we can straighten this out, well, then let's do that. Let's talk about what the legislation would be to offer this this proper departmental oversight. What would that be of who did what? What would that look like? Let's actually set up departmental oversight so that Commerce is responsible for thus and so, and it fits and segues very nicely into what the Department of Human Services is responsible for, and that segues very nicely into whatever the Department of Health is responsible for, and we have a system that actually works so that we don't have to wonder what's going on or why it's going on, why things change. We can actually have the oversight we need. We can actually have the numbers we need with ongoing independent third-party audits, and we can actually have the oversight that we need so that this healthcare field, which we say is costing us so much money, at least we know what the numbers are and who's responsible for what. That's my comment.
Okay, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'll just mention real quick, I'm sorry, Representative Mack, we do have the Department of Commerce here, and they can answer questions from a commerce perspective about the reserve issue. We may, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we may in fact want to take that now in process since that was brought up. I think it's a very good line of questioning, Representative Lane, and something everybody probably wants to understand better. Are commerce representatives... Julia Phillips is here from Commerce. Julie, do you want to help enlighten us about the reserve requirements for health plans?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Mr. Chair. I can just help frame the question since it was my question. And Mr. Leish is here too, so just good to get drag him down wherever he can. No, he'll stand in the back and smile. Mm-hmm. The question was asked, we're talking about, hello back behind the chair there. We were talking about what kind of reserves are necessary, and the Commissioner of Human Services was suggesting that the Commerce Department would better answer that question. You missed the dialogue we had about 400%, 500%. Is it really money at risk, or is it just cost plus and there's a backstop so you don't really need a reserve? That's been discussed at some length through all this discussion, and so the question for whichever Commerce representative would be is, how do you figure what's enough? And I think HMOs serving state programs are different than HMOs serving commercial programs. And so can you comment about that difference? That's the whole question, I think. Is that?
Yes. If you can state your name for the record and you know your position, who you represent, that would be great. Thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Julia Phillips. I'm the Life and Health Actuary for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I have been responsible for the last 16 years for providing technical expertise in reviewing the solvency levels of all health insurers in the state. For the past 12 years, that has included HMOs under a contract with an interagency agreement with the Minnesota Department of Health. I also am responsible for reviewing the rates that are charged by health insurers and HMOs. And I believe the question, if I can just restate it, was what is an adequate level of free reserves or surplus for an HMO to have, and perhaps that the answer is different for an HMO that is providing services to public program enrollees as compared to an HMO that is only providing services in the commercial market. That's a fair statement. Okay.
It is, yep.
Okay. I was involved in developing the formula that when people say 400% or 500%, I was in the room for many hours as we developed the formula to calculate these numbers. It's something that applies to any health insurer. For a for-profit corporation, we call it surplus or capital and surplus. For a nonprofit, that's kind of an awkward thing to say, and so we call it free reserves. Those free reserves are the money that is there in case something bad happens, so that the entity, whether it be for-profit or not-for-profit, does not run out of money, and so that it can keep its promises to the enrollees. We generally consider 200% to be the minimum level. And in fact, the legislature passed a law describing what the Commerce Department should do if the risk-based capital ratio falls below 200%. And there's a whole list of things that we do to try to repair the situation. There is no standard for in statute or in actuarial literature or in accounting literature for the comfortable amount of free reserves. The Commerce Department in general, and I'm kind of standing in here for the Assistant Commissioner, which is an open position right now, who is really in charge of the solvency reviews. The Commerce Department does not ever want to see an HMO or a health insurer being unable to cover its obligations. And there are many things that can impact that ability. There are sudden jumps in utilization. I'm not old enough to remember the flu epidemic of 1918, but it put many life insurance companies out of business because they had surplus but not enough. Therefore, we're always in a situation where if we say 400% is plenty, there's some chance that the next year there would be a bird flu epidemic or some other consideration, and by law, the coverage is unlimited for HMOs. By law, they can't say, oh, your contract covers only the first $1 million and now you're on your own. By law, the HMOs have to pay the medical expenses of their enrollees without limit. Therefore, I think that you may have noticed that over the past few years and under more than one governor and under more than one commerce commissioner, we have not been forthcoming with a number that would represent the comfortable or adequate level of free reserves for HMOs or for insurance companies. And I think that part of the reason we have not been forthcoming is because of the very uncertainty and our sense that you can criticize them having too much. You can say, you know, they shouldn't have too much, and I totally agree with that. However, we don't really know how much is too much. And the drawbacks of having too much, which is, well, the money could be put to better use elsewhere, they could lower their rates, they could charge less, really are outweighed by the drawbacks of saying, oops, well, 400% looked like a lot of money last year, but suddenly it's not enough. So I will try not to go on. I'm going to try to be brief, but that's kind of the capsule information that I have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, and I appreciate you coming over just to answer these questions. I have two questions. One is that, is it reasonable that the reserves, that the free reserves should grow every year for an HMO that serves in the state program section? And is it reasonable that one would have 500%, one would have 800%, drawing money from the same source?
Thank you, Representative Abler and members of the committee. The percentage varies depending on the volume of business that the entity has. So the formula, you probably remember the corridors that we used to have. And the corridors were based on something like, I think, 2 to 4 months for the insurers and Blue Cross and 1 to 3 months of claims and expenses in the prior year. The risk-based capital is similar to that, only it's supposed to be more finely tuned. It looks at the volume of business. It looks at the riskiness of the investments. It looks at the type of business where if they have stop-loss coverage, there's a higher charge. If they have dental coverage, it's a lower charge because dental is less risky. So to some extent, the surplus should grow every year. I would say that if you're looking at the percentage numbers, that ideally it would not. Ideally, even if the entity itself is doubling in size or shrinking in size, if 500% of company action level is a good level, then it should be 5%, 500% all the time. However, there are a number of things that it's not like steering a car down the road. And sometimes you find yourself oversteering. And I worked for a health insurance company for 10 years. I come from the dark side. You know, I've recovered. But you know, when we would be losing money, as we were, we lost a lot of money in 1987. And there was really an oversteering effect where the underwriters started getting very tough and they wouldn't accept a lot of applicants. And I was raising the rates. And, you know, the people who were administering claims were getting very tough because we all knew we were in trouble. And it kind of oversteered. And the next year, suddenly we were extremely profitable. And it was kind of like, you know, if you can tell me what the health care cost of a certain population is going to be in a year, you could get a job making a lot more money than I make because nobody really knows. So, you know, there's the ideal. If you look, and I have provided, you know, over the past few years, I have provided some historical RBC numbers, you know, to members of the state house. And if you look at those numbers, you can see that they do bounce around to a certain extent. And if you were to say to me, Julia, why did the Blue Cross Free Reserves go from a 600% RBC level to an 800% and then back down to a 500% or whatever, I would say, I don't know, and Blue Cross doesn't know either, because there are so many complex things that go into the mix. However, I will say that I certainly see the companies responding in their rate filings. We have a lot of companies across the United States that are filing their rates with the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight on healthcare.gov because they're raising their rates more than 10%. We haven't had that in Minnesota. Our rates are going up between 5 and 8% in general in the individual market in the past year. So, you know, to the extent that they have surplus, it does seem to be reflected in lower prices.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Feinwachs, briefly.
Mr. Chairman, members, briefly, first of all, to Julie, I heard you say there's a job open at the Commerce Department. Can I give you my contact information after the hearing? And secondly, I think the real issue here is this, and this is the question we need to ask. In the operation of these programs, is the state of Minnesota buying insurance from these organizations? Or, like an ERISA employer, are we holding our own risk and using these entities as disbursement agents? This is actually a threshold question, and addressing this would be useful in terms of framing this debate.
Ms. Phillips, do you have any response on that?
As far as the public programs, I would really have to defer to Commissioner Jessen, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Jessen? I do think this is an important question. It's, you know, this has been the elephant in the middle of the room for, like I said, all the years I've been in the legislature, and I think it's worth trying to get it if we can a little bit, without putting anybody unduly on the spot.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to briefly address this, and I would also like to ask Assistant Commissioner Leitz to weigh in as well. I'd be happy to briefly address this, and I would also like to ask Assistant Commissioner Leitz to weigh in as well. I think I said in my opening remarks that one of the things that concerned me when I came into this job was the way we did our pricing for the health plans, that we were basically looking back 3 years and then making adjustments for medical inflation. And that's why I thought we should change that model. Because while I understand that the plans are assuming some risk from year to year, I didn't think that, you know, there was a lot of risk, and I also just didn't think that provided incentives for doing things better, for changing, for lowering costs. So that's why we've been making a number of the changes to our purchasing process that we can. We, you know, we have talked about, you know, do we really just want to change that further? Those are some discussions, and at this point I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Leitz to weigh in.
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and members, I think as Commissioner Jessen said, I think that's very much the nature of why we're doing some of the changes that we're doing around competitive bidding, because I do think that there was some concern when we stepped back, looked at the way that we historically set rates, which was really to look at history plus trend, it did not provide a lot of incentive to contain costs within that model or to reward innovation within that model. And so when you move from that sort of a more administered rate setting process to one that is more price competitive in a market, you really do change the dynamic of how those rates are set, because now it's a function of the entities themselves providing what they will take to serve populations, as opposed to us administratively doing that work. So I do think that there's sort of a question. I think it becomes, Mr. Chair, a question moving forward. Really, has the process that we've put in place really changed the dynamic of how risk is or is not taken? And I would argue that we have sort of fundamentally really changed some of that dynamic moving forward.
Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can just add on to Commissioner Lights. I do think that one of the things we're looking at, kind of going back to where I talked about creating a third way, not just managed care contracting as we've done in the past, not just fee-for-service, one of the things that we do want to do to incentivize change is get, providers, and maybe providers then work with the health plans to take on more risk, upside and downside risk, gain sharing, to where we give them more flexibility so that they can so they're not just paying just for the test, and the incentives aren't towards overutilization. We hold them accountable for quality outcomes, but and to do that, to change the incentives, we need them to take on more risk. So I think that is clearly the direction we're heading. Competitive bidding was a good first step, I think.
Good conversation around that. I really appreciate the additional information and appreciate you coming over, Ms. Phillips. Representative Murphy is next, and then I've got Representative Mack and Representative Loeffler. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Mack for letting me budge in, because I did have a question in follow-up to this line of questioning. And it is either for Ms. Phillips or for Commissioner Jessen or Assistant Commissioner Lights. And I want to go back to your hypothetical about the bird flu and free reserves and risk. And so if, hypothetically, a health plan had, a population that really exceeded, their expectations in terms of utilization, and they blew through their reserves, what would happen to the enrollees? And would the state still have an obligation to provide care? So if the state still has an obligation to provide care, doesn't the state hold the ultimate risk in this situation?
Ms. Phillips.
Representative Mercy, Chairman. For a commercial population, I would answer that because we have it in Chapter 62D, what would happen to the HMO enrollment. I am not completely familiar with what would happen in the hypothetical area where the public programs, because I'm not sure to what extent they fall under the normal enrollment. So I guess I will kick the question over to Assistant Commissioner Lights. Looks like he's on the spot here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leifey, and I do think that's a useful distinction that that Julia drew between sort of the commercial part of the world where the state does not necessarily have an obligation to do that, and public programs where we do have to cover the costs. And really, I'm going to talk just real briefly about sort of the way then that the federal government has sort of thought about this issue. And when many states, and many states do contract with health plans to do administration of the Medicaid program, the rates that are paid by the state to those entities have to be sufficient to cover the expected costs of the program. And that's why it's so important that those rates be sufficient to do that. I think on the other hand, what we saw coming in was that the rates were certainly sufficient, and in many cases probably more than sufficient to cover that because of the margins that were on the program. So I think it's really a balance between those two things, which is ensuring that we are able to pay rates that are sufficient to cover the costs of the services that are being delivered to the population without paying so much that there is excess margin being gained at taxpayer expense. And that's really the balance, I think, that we always try to strike in these things.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thanks, yep. Mr. Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Lights. I understand that balance, and I think that's the right balance. But I think it's important for us to understand the the final obligation, who holds the final risk with regard to those people that are enrolled in the public programs. And as we talk about the financing, it's important to understand who holds that final risk. And I think that that point needs to be really underscored in this discussion. Thank you.
I think that's a very good point. I just want to lobby in here briefly to say this is at such the heart of the issue for so much of this stuff. We are, in a sense, alleviating some of the risk that we hold on behalf of taxpayers by using the health plan's reserves. And if we decide we don't want the health plans to have reserves for public programs, then the taxpayers will bear that completely. And so that's a policy discussion. Should the health plans bear part of the reserve, the risk through their reserves, or should they bear all of it, or should the taxpayers bear all of it? So, very good question. Representative Mack, and then Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. The first one is back to the issue of the $30 million that was donated or paid back from UCARE. And my question, I guess, is probably for the department. If nothing, I'm trying to get to, because we've heard a little bit of back and forth on the language that was used in the letter and what was stated, but I'm just trying to understand, if there was, when GAMC was done away with and that change was made, was there any change made at the department level, particularly after this letter was sent, and if anything was brought to the attention of you know, the overpayment or the excess payment that was there after the change with GAMC? Has the department done anything to look at that issue? Has that been addressed, and if not, why?
Mr. Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you have to think about this a little bit chronologically. So GAMC ended, I think, in the spring of 2010, my recollection. You all were here, and I wasn't in this seat. And UCARE made their donation on March 14th, I believe, 2011. You know, and honestly, I didn't see the letter from Nancy Feldman that's been much discussed here until recently. But so I think your question really is, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, look, once this issue about kind of the rates, you know, was issued, you know, were we inappropriately using our MA payments to kind of subsidize the health plans because they were taking a hit on GAMC, and GAMC goes away, you know, what did the department do? You know, it's a little harder for me and for Commissioner Lights because we weren't there then. I mean, I think that the question I can answer is when I became aware of this allegation of wrongdoing, kind of what did we do? And I think that, you know, one, after GAMC went away, we knew, and after we were doing competitive bidding, we knew we weren't paying, you know, doing rate setting in this way anymore. So if there were concerns, we had changed that. I think there's also a question about, is there a duty to go back and look at what was done in the past if questions have been raised and say, should we investigate that? And that's where I was trying to say earlier, at the same time I learned of these concerns, I also learned that there was a federal investigation into this matter, which we are cooperating with. And I thought that was the best way, cooperating with that investigation, to look at this issue, which, you know, I see, as I said, looking at chronologically as different than the UCARE donation. And as I said before, that from my perspective, you know, they came in, they said it was a donation, and when I went, sat down, and as Mr. Lights knows, looked through all of those 2010 contracts because I wanted to know if there were things, you know, that were done in 2010 that were effective in 2011, because I wanted to know if there were changes that we could make. But I didn't see anything in those contracts that required UCARE to give us that money back. And as far as there's something that should have been investigated that, you know, morally caused them to do this, you know, that's something that, you know, perhaps this investigation will reveal. But that was before our time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack.
Brief follow-up to that question. So if I understand correctly, you had said that some of the issues with rates that had possibly led to this excess, did I understand you correctly that some of that had been dealt with already? Some of those issues have been addressed, and if if I am understanding you correctly, then that would those would be in effect from here on out. So it could be safe to assume that this year UCARE and the other plans, but we know for sure UCARE would not necessarily be seeing that same excess over and above what they need to meet their obligations.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, you're correct. The what my understanding of the concerns raised is that there was this interplay between, which some say was inappropriate, between the GAMC rates and the MA rates. Because GAMC went away, that's one reason that we're not, you know, that that's obviously not an issue today. But I think even more fundamentally, what we did when we came in and, you know, recognizing, as I think Commissioner Lights and I both tried to say, that we thought we were leaving money on the table. So we really did the competitive bidding exercise to try and to clear the decks and kind of press reset on the rate setting process. To introduce some risk and competition into this. And we took not only, while we did that in the metro area, we took what we learned from those rates and applied a rate cut in greater Minnesota, albeit not as large a one, as a result of that too. So I think for a number of reasons, it's not a question about what we're doing today. I think these questions were raised about what happened in the past, and as I said, I think those are being looked at.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Mack.
Could I just ask if Mr. Feinwax, in your research and you're looking at this, would you agree with what the commissioner is saying, that some of the issues that maybe led to the $30 million in excess, that they have been addressed, that we're moving forward in a direction where that wouldn't take place again, or where the money is a little bit more tightly held, whether it's by the department? I guess I'm just wondering if you have a response.
I believe that the commissioner and her staff are in fact beginning to look into these questions, and I commend her and them for that. I think the inquiry is long overdue, and I think we've got quite a ways to go, because one of the issues apparently that's been raised here is there's nothing in the contract that required anybody to give back any money. But there may be something in the federal law that requires them to give back the money. And those are the issues, I assume, that will be explored.
Representative Mack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that. And then my other question on a separate issue, I'm just, you know, lots of questions, and this is all very complex. And at the end of Mr. Feinwach's presentation, I'm just asking this because he provided this, and I didn't necessarily see material from anyone else, but he has kind of three bullet points here at the end. I don't know if everyone's had a chance to see that. Independent third-party audits, encounter data claims and payment data, and a prohibition on the state's actuary serving as a consultant to the state's health plan vendors. My question is, I guess, to the plans and to the department, and this might be overly simplified, and if it is, I apologize, but I guess I'm just wondering, what are your response to these three asks of... They just happen to be Mr. Feinwachs, but I'm just curious, what are your issues with these? What are your concerns? Why do they not work? Why do they work? And then if Mr. Feinwachs could respond to theirs. I guess this question is coming from, I've had lots of conversations round and round with various people, and this is a great opportunity where you're all right here and it's not bouncing back and forth. So I feel that it would be helpful to just kind of get some straightforward responses to some of these things.
We'll start with Commissioner Jessen, then maybe you can just raise your hand. No, we'll go across the table here. Okay, Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, we strongly support having independent third-party audits. We also, the concept of having kind of a prohibition on the state's actuary serving as a consultant to the state health plan vendors, you know, that is, we think that's important. I mean, we've already included, basically, I think, that prohibition in our contracts as a matter of contract. To have it in statute, we think, is appropriate. You know, I think there's some, as with everything, a few details you have to work out and how do you define it all, but I think that's important. You know, and I think, I was trying to say earlier that I think that it really is important to have quick access to this encounter and price data. We've started collecting that last year. We need to make sure it's both usable and that it's accurate so that we can make decisions going forward on usable, accurate data. so that we know more how our dollars are being spent. I think we've got to start on that. That's something that we endorse.
Mr. Barsh?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mack, on the first bullet on the issue of independent third-party audits, I think I'll rephrase what Ms. Bruner said earlier, which is, you know, we're audited by multiple entities and agencies now. We'd welcome a different independent third-party audit. Obviously, someone's version of how that looks in a bill is different than someone else's version of how that looks in a bill, so I don't want to endorse any piece of legislation at this time, but the idea of an independent third-party audit is something we have supported. I think we stated that last year when this committee heard this. In terms of the encounter and claims payment data, we've been submitting the encounter data to the department for years, as Commissioner Jessen just stated, beginning with the contract that was signed at the end of 2010. That includes specific price information. We do that in the manner and form that's specified by the department. So if they are working to change that in a way that helps them validate that data, we'll certainly comply and are happy to do so. And then, as she also stated, the prohibition on the state's actuary serving as a consultant to the state's health plan vendors, I think, as the commission just stated, that's a part of the contract right now. We don't see any issue with putting that in place as a way to keep any conflict of interest from occurring.
Mr. Finewax.
Mr. Chairman, members, obviously the definition of independent and the independent third-party audit is absolutely key, and if they are indeed independent, they would be a wonderful thing. We live in an age of computers and data, and there is no reason that the state should not be able to track encounter and payment data for its programs and its tax monies right now. Most of you have on your smartphones enough computational power to do almost the task that needs to be done. And there's no excuse for us not doing it, and I welcome the responses that say we should do this. And in terms of memorializing in statute the prohibition against the state's actuary consulting, I think it's an excellent idea. It's long overdue, and I would prefer to have it in statute because, of course, contractual provisions can be waived.
Representative Mack, have I got a bill for you?
I was going to say, Mr. Carey.
I think Representative Lane does, too, just to be bipartisan here.
Well, from those, I appreciate the responses, and it sure doesn't sound like we're all that far off from where we all think we want to go. It doesn't sound like what Mr. Finewax, at least the way it's outlined here. Mr. Barsh, you said obviously the details are key, but I guess that's just what I'm trying to get at. In individual conversations, it seems like one side says they don't provide it, the other side says, yes, we do provide it, and trying to really understand what actually is being provided, what does the state have, what don't we have. And from all of your responses, it sure seems like, you know, we're a lot closer than we are far apart, but still trying to figure out where this is all falling apart. So thanks.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to everyone for paying attention to what I think is an important issue. And I want to commend the Commissioner Jessen and Assistant Commissioner Lights for taking on this issue and trying some new approaches. I think we're kind of overdue on looking at this issue, not that a lot of people around this table and elsewhere haven't tried, and I think we're making progress. But once again, we're still focusing on managed finances rather than managed care, and that's my biggest concern. Even moving forward, it's a lot about competitive bidding, which was based more about bids than past performance. Even though every single one of the bidders has had extensive long-term performance data, not as robust as we'd like. But we need to move forward, and I think because the whole system to me has to be focused on managed care for better outcomes, because the risk isn't just financial. The risk is to the finance budget for health and human services. When kids aren't healthy, they don't learn, and that adds to our education budget. When someone's mental health issues aren't addressed as effectively and as quickly as they need to be, we don't get them back to work. And self-sufficiency. And you know, the cost to our criminal justice system when we don't deal effectively with criminal chemical dependency are very, very clear. And so the risks of our system are more than just financial related to this contract. They're related to absolutely everything we do and have impacts beyond the scope of this committee. What I would like to hear a little bit more about is a new area of the future. And we did this for finance reasons, not necessarily because anyone's proven that managed care entities are the best and and best able to step up to serve people with serious disabilities. It was really more about how to save money in the next budget going forward. And I'd like to hear how we're going to balance the financial risk and the contracting for serving people with disabilities. Because right now, we as a state under the fee-for-service system are taking that risk. And even though we know there are some people who I've heard as much as $1 million a month of the cost of their medical care, it's shared around the whole state. And we're going to divide that sharing of risk into individual contracts with up to 5 different health plans in 5 or 6 or 8 different regions of the state. And so we could have dividing that risk into 35 contracts that I'm afraid that when we divvy up that risk and assure everyone against getting that really catastrophic case, we're going to once again be back in here in a few years talking about how much reserves were built up to deal with this population. And without effective quality of care measures to see whether or not we're really buying what people need, because particularly for this population, we use Medicaid to buy social services, independent living skills, things that are not going to meet the traditional health plan definition of medical necessity. And every time we've brought a new group into managed care, we've had big problems with that definition of medical necessity and what's necessary. So if we could spend just a little bit of time saying how these issues are being addressed in that tough burden of new responsibility that we've given you, and I'd be interested in both the department's perspective as well as that of the health plans.
Commissioner Jessen, you want to start it off? Or
I'll defer to Assistant Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Lights, okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I think you've hit on a series of very good questions, and let me just step back and give the committee a little bit of a sort of a process update and where we're at on things. And As you know, last year there was a real brief one, Mr. Chair. Don't worry, I'm not going to go on at great length here. We passed a law that brought individuals into managed care, both adults and children, in an opt-out perspective. And we're processing through that in a phased fashion, so that we're bringing on new groups monthly into this year. And the children, which have not been in SNBC products, special needs basic care products, before, will sort of be the last group to transition in, because they're the group that both we have the least amount of experience with and the plans have the least amount of experience with. And so we're working through that process. I think the way that we've tried to do this is a really open process of bringing in the disabled advocates, bringing in the disabled community, working with the plans and providers to try to make this transition as smooth as possible for individuals. You're right, there are some issues around unpredictability of risk with disabled populations that are different than a families and children populations. One of the reasons traditionally that has been in the fee-for-service world. But we have learned some things through the development of the SNBC product over the past several years. This is obviously a much bigger expansion, and so as we go about the rate-setting process for this and as we go about contracting with the plans to do this, I think reporting and monitoring is going to be the key piece of knowing where we're at, both from a financial perspective as well as any transitional concerns that might be there. You also hit another very important issue, which is the quality of care measures, and you're absolutely right that some of the existing measures that we would traditionally use for a non-disabled population don't necessarily translate as well to a disabled population. And that's something that I think collectively as a community, that's something we need to work on to make sure that we get the right measures in place. Again, I think folks in Minnesota's disabled community have been really national leaders on helping to think about actual functional status measures that we can start to put in place. But those aren't there quite yet. And so that is another piece that I think we're going to have to closely monitor moving forward on this. So those are some sort of thoughts on kind of where how that process is rolling out and the issues that we're considering. The final one that I'll mention really relates to how do we properly risk adjust for these populations as well, because as you've identified, there is larger levels of disparity in costs on a month-to-month basis as well as risk on a month-to-month basis for folks. And so that's something that we also need to continue to work on. Again, we're trying to do this in a phased approach so that we're addressing these issues as we move forward while trying to be careful not to overwhelm the system at once, but also trying to sort of know what those issues are so that we can prospectively look at them.
Mr. Bartsch?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loeffler, I think both you and Assistant Commissioner Leitz raised all the relevant questions, and one of the reasons why, as he mentioned, there's a number of people working together to try and work through this. It is a new process, but again, measuring outcomes and also how the program works from a financial standpoint are important as you all evaluate whether or not it's something to continue moving forward. And we're very happy to work with the state and stakeholders as we roll this process out to make sure that it's in the best interest of everyone.
Representative Barrett. Representative Loeffler, real quickly.
Well, I was just going to follow up and say I'd be interested in following up further about some new approaches to sharing that risk, because I don't want us to pay for that risk more than we need to. And it's a population we've served within the state budget for a long period of time. So I think maybe that there might be some new answers there.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions here. I'll try to make them brief, but the first one is for Commissioner Jessen. You had mentioned earlier a federal investigation going on. You also mentioned, and it's obvious that some things can be discussed, or can't be discussed, I should say, because it's an ongoing investigation, but certainly there are things that can be discussed, and certainly us being the deliberative body of the legislature responsible for health and human services, both from a policy and a finance perspective, we would need to know if there's any risk going forward from the state budget or otherwise. So question I have for you is, at what point were you aware that there is a federal investigation? Is there anything in writing you could share with us? And then which branch of the federal government is investigating?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, with regard to when I became aware of this last summer, when we were approached to ask for our cooperation in the investigation, to give, you know, documents and other information, that's when I became aware of it. I was asked not to say anything to anyone. We very, very few people, even within the department, knew about this. And I specifically, as I think I mentioned, but I'm not sure, said earlier last Friday, I called and just asked for specific information, specifically to be able to tell you that there was an ongoing investigation by federal authorities into some of the allegations which have been discussed here. And that I was given permission to say that and only that. So I asked specifically if I could say who in the federal government was doing the investigation, and I was told I could only say that it were federal authorities were conducting this investigation. And I'm unfortunately really, as far as your question about some of the scope of this, I was just told not to say anything, but I would also say I'm not sure I even have the answers to most of those questions. You know, the federal government's doing the investigation, we're cooperating. I can surmise some things based on what they've asked us, but I don't know the scope of their investigation or what they're looking at or frankly, how serious it is.
And Representative Barrett, I'm anticipating that at some point, and I know Senator Ninow's here as well, that we would want to get a report back from the federal government on their findings. I'm sure they'd either issue those anyway, or we would want to hear them. And I would make a commitment on behalf of one committee, at least in the legislature, that we would request that, so we'd have those answers. Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move on. I would like to maybe know more about that. I think there is more that could be shared. If there's anything in writing that you could actually transfer over to our body, I think that would be good. I think we do have a need to know in this area. We are certainly one of three branches of the state government, and I know there are certain times when the feds can tell us what to do and other times they can suggest. And I'd like to understand more about whether they're suggesting or telling. But that maybe is a conversation for another day. Question, Mr. Bartsch, about the UCARE return of $30 million voluntary contribution. Do you know what the reserves were of which that $30 million were based upon?
Mr. Chairman, President Barrett, I don't represent UCARE. I think you'd have to ask them that question.
Okay.
Let's see if anybody's still here from UCARE. Is there another question you ask? Well, I think there's going to need.
Yeah, they're kind of built on each other, actually.
Why don't I do this? I'm going to hold that question for a moment, Representative Barrett. I want to mention we've got Representative Franson, Representative McElfatrick, Representative Benson, Representative Grimhagen, Representative Huntley, Senator Ninow, and then perhaps some closing comments to get done in 15 minutes. and then we'll have to close things off.
Mr. Chair, if I could just continue. I do have a couple other questions. I'll try to get to those first. I don't want to lose the floor here.
Representative Burke, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Barsh, can you describe the nature of the conversations you've had with DHS about voluntary contributions being made back to the state? What's the nature of them? How often have they happened? Who has been involved in those conversations?
Mr. Barsh.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barrett, after UCARE announced their decision last year, I think the governor indicated that they would be contacting all of the HMOs about that. We got a call from the Department of Human Services. We declined their request because our situation was different than UCARE's.
Representative Barrett.
Okay. The next question then is for Commissioner Jensen. Can you tell us what your conversations have been with the HMOs regarding this issue? I know back in March of 2011, there was a communication out of the governor's office that talked about four different things that you were on, and certainly some of these you wanted to do very quickly. One is competitive bidding and managed care. Another is an executive order on disclosure and accountability. The third one being a return for taxpayers. And let me just read you this, and maybe you could reply and see if you could let us know what's been done in that area. Following a voluntary contribution of $30 million by UCARE from its excess reserves, the administration will continue to call upon the state's current contracted providers to return its own excess reserves and profits, with the industry's most recent numbers to be disclosed as required on April 1st. So the communication happened on March 23rd. The disclosure should have happened on April 1st. It's February 14th. If you could let us know where we're at with that and how much money we could expect to get back.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, after that communication went out, I thank you for reminding me of it. I did actually call up and set up meetings with each of the three major health plans. I held meetings with them. I talked with them. I asked them. And they, as Mr. Barsh said, all told me no. It was after that, and I was trying to think about next steps, that I thought, well, if they're not going to take the step of making a donation to the state, then what can we do under the 2011 current contracts? I looked at that. I didn't see a lot of options. And that's when I thought of the idea of, well, let's see if we can get them to agree, at least for this contract, to a cap on profits. And so I then approached each of the plans about that, and we ultimately got that agreement, which, as I said, I do want to express appreciation to the plans for agreeing to that.
And then one follow-up, and then... Sure, okay, good.
So then I have in front of me an email, or a letter, actually, from UCARE regarding their $30 million contribution. And they say the $30 million represents what we consider to be excess 2010 operating margin for state public programs, plural. The margin was due to several factors, sluggish economy and high unemployment that increased the eligibility and enrollment, but the utilization of health care was significantly lower. So the question I probably have for Ms. Commissioner Jessen is, wouldn't those same criteria apply to all of the HMOs? So that there should be excess operating margins due to economic factors overall.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I certainly made that argument when I met with them, you can be sure, and called upon them and their civic duty to follow UCARE's lead. And they said no, so I went to my second step.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barrett. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have about four questions, and I hope they move fast. And if they've been covered, just let me know. And
can we maybe keep it down to a couple? We're literally 10 minutes left with five other people who need to.
All right. I believe that this question has been asked numerous times over the years, and I did not hear it today, but who sets and certifies the Medicaid rate in the state of Minnesota to the federal government?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, the rates that are set for paid for capitation are set by the Department of Human Services. Those rates are certified as being actuarially sound by our contract actuary, and then the CMS has to approve those rates as part of the process.
Representative Franzen.
Okay, then moving on here, and to Commissioner Jensen here, you had mentioned a profit of, you know, you're going to cap the profit at 1% that the health plans had voluntarily at, or said that they would do, correct?
Commissioner Jensen.
Yes. Okay.
Representative Franzen.
Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Jensen, could you explain, in your opinion, what is profit and who defined it? And how is the profit calibrated, and how does the public truly know that profit was capped?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, we defined profit as operating margin, and one of the things we're going to do, I think Assistant Commissioner Lights discussed earlier, the audits that we're doing of the health plans, one of the things, in addition to looking at administrative costs, that we'll be very careful to look at is how... Is whether or not they are actually returning what is in excess of 1% of that operating margin. So so that is one thing we will be very carefully looking at the department.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Franzen, thank you. Next, Representative McElfatter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to all of you for answering all of our questions. I have a couple of concerns, two questions, and I'll take it down to one. It seems like there was... awareness over a considerable period of time about what I would term an excess in the normal reserves. And quite a period of time has gone by, and we're just looking at this now. And I'm wondering, I guess primarily for Commissioner Jessen, in recognizing that we had a substantial amount of money over what could be considered normal reserves, do you feel that there should have been a responsibility to bring that question to the legislature, just simply because this just seems a little out of norm?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I've only been in this job 1 year and 1 month, and I think for myself, when I got here, I felt that the issue of reserves was very much being discussed in the legislature last year. I mean, I thought that was something that was very much a topic of discussion that I didn't need to raise or bring attention to. What I did, you know, in my job was to try and negotiate tougher contracts so that we were not contributing as much to those reserves as we had in the past. But so just given my short period of time here, I think that's the only way I can respond. I can't speak for previous commissioners.
Representative McElfetter.
Thank you.
Representative Benson, and then Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for the commissioner. We've been here about 3 hours, and I think we could probably boil down to most of our conversations have been around accountability and public trust. And you're a professor of law, and I just draw your attention to this one email. It's been brought up again before, and it continues to evolve around, for me at least, this $30 million. Having unfortunately been involved in other investigations myself, I know that you know, the probability of discovery would require that if you're trying to keep things secret, you wouldn't send emails. I just want you to respond to it, and I thought we were going to handle this through phone calls. And I'm stating the obvious to many, but that seems odd that that would be in an email unless it was in order to make sure that it wouldn't be brought up in discovery, that there was some question about the legality of not splitting the $30 million.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm glad you asked that question so I have a chance to address it. I wasn't trying to keep anything secret. I was the one who went to CMS and told them about this the next day after I sent that email. Well, actually, if you read the chain of emails, I was answering an email both about how to characterize things in the press release and also about giving a heads up to legislative leadership. And I had suggested when I talked with folks that they call the chairs and minority leads about this and talk with them and explain it. Now, that wasn't because I was trying to hide anything, and I think if you ask the chairs of this committee, they will tell you that I'm often someone who advocates actually talking with people rather than sending emails. We were actually kind of as early in the session. We were trying to establish working relationships, new working relationships, and I was pushing all my staff to actually not just send emails, but to go over and talk with people. And that's what I meant by that.
Okay, Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I've got some comments. One on the reserves, second on the so-called federal investigation, and then a suggestion where we might go. Like Ms. Phillips, I don't remember the 1917 flu epidemic.
No comment.
I am aware of the 80s, and we had a whole bunch of HMOs in Minnesota that went bankrupt in the 80s. And that doesn't mean they just went out of business. It means the cost of that went on to the other healthcare providers. So it's not just a hypothetical case that these companies can go bankrupt. It's happened before, and we need some reserve to protect for that. On the federal investigation, my understanding is that somebody has filed a court case, and that HHS and the federal government must investigate, no matter the legitimacy of that or not. They have to investigate. That doesn't mean we've done anything wrong. And I will say that if it's related to the appropriate federal contributions that are usually made, if we don't get investigated a lot, it's because we're not doing our job. We need to maximize our federal contributions on all these programs. And, you know, we send $1.17 to Washington for every dollar we get back. And we need to try to get that up to 117. And I will say on there's all kinds of things, intergovernmental transfers. I mean, it used to be that actually the University of Minnesota would write a check to the state of Minnesota for several million dollars at 10 minutes to midnight. And at 10 minutes after midnight, the state would write them a check back, and the feds had to match it. And it was legal. And if we don't have our, you know, we've got a floor of people in the Elmer and Anderson building trying to figure out how to maximize our federal share. Unfortunately, there's entire buildings in Washington of their bureaucrats trying to prevent this.
We've got to care for that, Representative Huntley.
We need, if we get investigated once in a while, we ought to be. And if we're not pushing the edge, then we're not doing our job. The last thing about I would say is in the 2008 Legislative Auditor's Report, which I have right here, he said, Minnesota should continue to rely significantly on managed care to serve enrollees in the state's publicly funded health care programs, but with enhanced efforts to contain medical and administrative spending. We passed many laws in 2008, 2009 to do what the legislative auditor thought we ought to do. And there was things passed last year that addressed these same issues. And I think that we ought to have the legislative auditor look at this. I mean, the legislative auditor's office, I think, is the one part of state government that everybody agrees may not like the results, but nobody questions whether they're correct or not. And I think that we ought to have the legislative auditor redo that whole study, see what we've done since 2008, and see if that has made any difference, and that what we could do in addition to get more information that we need.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you for holding this hearing. If I could get a page, I've got a handout for the members.
Okay. If you want to go ahead with your statement, because we're almost out of time.
Absolutely. I just wanted to, this is just for the members' benefit.
Yep.
Earlier, Representative Huntley made a comment, and correct comment, actually, but I think that in the context of what I'm handing out is kind of indicative of some of the underlying problem or challenge or whatever word you want to use there with what we have in this particular circumstance. Representative Huntley, you mentioned that the federal government certifies the rates, and they do, absolutely. And the implication there is that we've gone through the process here at the state level, and the feds have seen it and certified the rates, and everything should be fine. And maybe it is. But what you're getting, members, is a report from the GAO, General Accounting Office, to the United States Senate committees and the United States House committees. And you can read this at your leisure. I know you guys live for this stuff in the House, right, these reports. But really the pertinent part is in the inside of the cover, you're inside of the front page cover on the bottom. There's two paragraphs on the bottom of that page, and if you really read those, that will essentially set the context. I just want to read a couple of statements. This entire report is about rate setting for managed care. CMS regulations do not include standards for the type, amount, or age of the data used to set rates, and states are not required to report to CMS on the quality of the data. And down lower, it says that all of this, which places billions of federal and state dollars at risk for misspending. Basically, what the GAO said is, they certified the rates, but the process and the underlying procedures and policies and the data are not necessarily reliable because of the way the system is set up. And I would just suggest to you, as you move forward on this topic, when we hear conversations and we hear testifiers that say, yes, we're out of it, we have these reports, ask the question, do they mean anything? When we hear that the rates are certified by the feds, ask the question, does that mean anything? Because based on this report, it maybe doesn't. And we have to challenge that and ask, is the underlying data accessible, available, reliable? Are the procedures that we as a legislature set up really building us to come to a good outcome?
Thank you, Senator Nino. Real briefly, Representative Liebling, we're already over
time.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to really express appreciation to the commissioner and her staff. And, you know, in 13 months, she's obviously done a whole lot to begin to tackle this very difficult issue, and I just want to express our appreciation for the work that she's done and to everybody for sitting here and going through this today.
And I appreciate that, and I'll extend my appreciation to all of our testifiers and all the people who helped them with their testimony. I think this is a very important hearing, and I want to thank all the members for sticking around and asking good questions. Representative Abel, you get the last word.
Well, thanks, and I want to echo Representative Liebling and Scott Walt about that. Thank you for this. I think this was a very good hearing. We had a lot of respect, a lot of good data. More to come when the next bill comes up with whatever the product of this will be. Just an announcement for my members. We were going to meet at 4:30. It's Valentine's. Can you come to my office right now for about 6 minutes, and then you can go and we'll not have the hour-long meeting. How's that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we stand adjourned.